Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am Sean M. Myers. The M stands for Human Target. And with me, as always, is my co-host and bat cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
Sean, riddle me this. Why does Bat Cousin Jim cheat at all the reunion games? He thinks the rest of us are just dumb and dumber.
Ugh, I know. I'm sorry you had to deal with him. I was talking to Bat Cousin Alicia, and she was a real treat to talk to. She's very good at sharing stories. Our special guest this month is our Bat Cousin and friend of the network, Captain Entropy. Welcome, Captain. Great to have you on the show. I can't wait to hear what you brought for the reunion to eat.
Thank you, Bat Cousins Sean and Paul. I'm so thrilled to be here. I brought two dishes.
Uh-oh.
Yep. My wife, Mrs. Negentropy, makes a delicious broccoli salad called Trees and Seeds. It has bacon in it.
Gotta be good, then.
Right. And the broccoli reminds me of the tree in the Wayne Foundation building. But I also use the reunion as an excuse to barbecue a bat brisket. So if I make a mistake or come across a little tired, just remember I've been cooking for 14 hours.
Paul, while I chow down on all of that food, why don't you remind our listeners what this show is all about?
You got it. Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with all new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even the Demon and the Human Target. Both are in this issue. Your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out, and they are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion.
Captain, we would love to hear about your history with the Batman Family and Detective Comics, including your favorite Bat Family member. You requested to be on this issue over a year ago. Can you tell us why?
Well, the short version is that the lead story in this issue is one of my favorite comic stories of all time, but I will flesh that out a little. My older brother read comics when he was young, so like Bat Cousin Chris Franklin, I've had comics around for as long as I can remember. For me, Batman Family was a way to get multiple great heroes in one comic.
There you go.
But I wasn't being that calculated when I picked this one up, because I was 6 and a half. It was the very first issue of Batman Family and the very first issue of Detective Comics I ever got. I loved all the stories, especially the Demon story and the Human Target story, because they were my introductions to those characters. But that lead Batman story had a message of hope and doing the right thing even when it's hard, and that stayed with me. That's why I asked to be on this episode as soon as you announced you were doing the show. You asked my favorite Bat Family member, and that's a tough one because I love Alfred with all the history that he brings to the table and all his amazing abilities and his dry wit. And I love Nightwing because he's just amazing and he's got almost all the capabilities of Batman plus social skills and a sense of humor. But really, I think my favorite is Tim Drake, because for Tim, the intellectual parts of the job came easily and he had to work really hard at the physical pieces. And I can relate to that. And so he's probably my favorite.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing.
That's great. Thanks. Now we're going to get into Detective Comics number 483, starring the Batman family. It is cover dated April, May of 1979. The release date was January 11th, 1979. It is 64 pages with no ads, cover price for $1. And for that dollar, you get six all new stories. And the cover artist is Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
What do you guys think of the cover? Captain, can you describe the cover and give us your thoughts? And we'll start with the front cover, and then we'll move on to the back cover.
Okay, so I love this cover. I love this comic so much that the cover has almost come off of my hard copy, but that wasn't on purpose. I love the cover. I'll talk about the trade dress first. There's black block text across the top announcing that this is a fabulous 40th anniversary issue, the 40th anniversary of Batman's first appearance in Detective Comics number 27. So for that reason, I'm extra double honored to be on Batman Family Reunion. Below that is a beautifully garish red and yellow banner. The middle of the banner reads Detective Comics in the distinctive Detective font. Those words are flanked by the DC bullet on the left and the Dollar Comic logo with the cover date and the number on the right. Below that is the Batman Family logo in red and black. This is a terrific logo. I don't know if Martin Gray is going to agree with me or not, but I love it. And this is the last time they used it in Detective Comics. And I don't know why. There's a blurb next to it that says, in six sensational new stories. The rest of the cover is split vertically into two scenes, both at the same spot in Crime Alley about two decades apart. The left half shows Joe Chill murdering Thomas Wayne, while Martha Wayne and little Bruce look on in horror. There's a blurb that says, this is the way it began. Thomas Wayne's murder started Batman's crime-fighting career. One thing we can say about Zack Snyder is that he gave Martha more respect than this. She is not mentioned in the blurb. The right half shows Batman in the position of Joe Chill, and he's beating up a criminal while his benefactor and mentor Leslie Tompkins looks on in horror. The blurb there says, and this is the way it ends, the killer instinct catches up with Batman. The art by JLGL PBHN is amazing. He's known for doing the model sheets for DC merchandising. So the Batman is, of course, on model, except that he's way more enraged and menacing than he ever looked in a Clark Bar ad. The cover, like the stories about Batman's struggle, he has to fight against the temptations of vengeance and violence to stay good while he battles evil. So he's looking into the abyss and the abyss is gazing back into him.
Wow. Great summary. And yeah, this is a cover that will separate just about anybody from their dollar. It's the way it began, the parallel, the poses, the location. You pointed it all out. I mean, I love it too. And you're right. Usually in all those promotional images that he draws, they're all smiling and happy. And Batman is not happy here. Leslie is really taken aback at his brutality against this guy who has threatened her. You can't get much better than this. Sean?
Yeah, it is a fantastic cover. And Bat Cousins could take me to task because it's quote unquote a boxed cover, but in my mind, it's not a boxed cover because that's just when like the things are down on the side. Mm-hmm. No, I think this is fantastic. It's such a great image. The parallel images just work together so well. I don't know that I really have anything to add. I just echo everything that you guys said. Like that front cover is fantastic. So we're going to flip it over and go to the back cover. And the back cover is drawn by Dick Giordano, and it's also landscape. So up in the corner in script, it says, happy anniversary from the whole Batman family. I guess we'll get into that. In the Batcave, there are Batman is front and center, and then surrounding him is Alfred, Batgirl, Commissioner Gordon, Robin, the Batmobile, the Batcomputer, and then back in the corner in the Batcage is Joker, Riddler, and Penguin.
Love that part.
What do you guys think of this picture?
I think it's terrific. You actually get to see Batman smiling here, and he's smiling in a pleasant way, not the I'm about to break half your ribs way. The characters look totally on model. It looks like, you know, the Bat family sent out a greeting card.
Yeah, that's exactly what I love it. This is currently the background screen on my computer. I mean, this is one of the most iconic images for me of the Batman family. It's the stars of this magazine that we've been covering for the last 2 years. So we'll get the Gabriel's horn out of the way right away with the giant size Bat computer. So that's ineligible for Gabriel's horn later, but fantastic image. You got the sports car Batmobile, the criminals in the Bat jail, which I love. I mean, just fantastic. Make sure to check out our gallery, folks, if you haven't seen this image.
If I have one really small quibble, I don't like it says happy anniversary from the whole Batman family, because obviously Catwoman, a ton of villains aren't there.
Well, you know, Batwoman's not there. Right, Man-Bat's not there.
Yeah, Batgirl.
It's from the Batman family that Dick Giordano wanted to draw.
Yeah,
that
it should just be from the Batman family. I think Dick Giordano is a fantastic artist. Yeah, I think he's really great. I don't think he gets enough credit. And even though I don't know necessarily that I would put him in my top five, Captain, when you were talking about Jose being the house artist, and that's really like what you think of these characters, I think Dick Giordano comes a really, really close second as to being on model to what you think of these Bronze Age characters, what they look like. They really, really look like they're quote unquote supposed to look like.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Neil Adams influence. I mean, he was partner with Neil Adams, right? Mm-hmm. Continuity and an executive at DC for many years. I mean, he's just a tremendous artist. He did the Crime Alley story. Obviously, Dick Giordano drew the first installment of that from 20-some issues ago, that written by Denny O'Neill. And so I think he wanted a little piece of this issue as well, the 40th anniversary issue.
I agree. And the other thing that I think is significant about Dick Giordano is that all the people that we think of as great house model or house look DC artists or great bat artists like JLGL or Jim Aparo, Dick Giordano inked all those guys.
Yeah. So
he did more inking than he was a great penciler, but he did more inking than penciling. Yeah. And I think sometimes my memory of the images mixes together because of that.
Yeah, no, fair point. Excellent point.
That is an excellent, and that would be a way to tie all of that artwork in together and, yep. and have a continuity.
Yeah, yeah. So as I mentioned, check out our portrait gallery. We will post the image of both the front and the back cover, as well as obviously some additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery. Sean, could you please remind our listeners where that is on the interwebs?
Of course, because I have that memorized and I'm not reading off of a piece of paper. http://fireandwaterpodcast.com/
Wait, how many slashes was that? I missed.
Now let's jump into our first story.
Okay, our first story is entitled The Curse of Crime Alley, starring Batman, of course, 16-pager, written by Denny O'Neill with art by Don Newton and Dan Adkins. Fabulous art, later reprinted, obviously, in Tales of the Batman Don Newton hardcover, but also in Sean's favorite Best of DC Digest from 1980 that he's waving in front of the screen right now. This is a sequel to the classic Detective number 457, There's No Hope in Crime Alley, that was written by Denny O'Neill as well, but had art by Dick Giordano. My copy was the first comic that I ever got signed by anybody. I love that story so much. And this is a sequel, at least a thematic sequel to that. The Batman in The Curse of Crime Alley. We open our story in what used to be Park Row, the ritziest neighborhood in Gotham City. But that was 20 years ago, before two brutal slayings occurred. It's now called Crime Alley. We see a feeble old man about to be mugged by two punks. But the man reminds them that this is the night that Batman visits Crime Alley every year, and the punks reconsider and skedaddle. In fact, Batman has been watching them from above and now moves on to meet with Leslie Tompkins, who still doesn't understand why he comes to visit her every year. After a quick flashback to a familiar origin story, Leslie tells Batman that there is something bad brewing lately in Crime Alley. Batman questions some hoods on a stakeout in a car and finds out that Maxie Zeus has hired them and a bunch of other lowlifes to watch an old apartment building to wait for Long John Logan and rub him out if they see him. It seems that Long John has had a change of heart and has turned into an informant. But curiously, the hood said that Long John would come out a few minutes after it started to rain, or he wouldn't come out at all. Batman realizes that Zeus has planned something that can't be good for the over 2,000 people in the apartment complex. Batman and Leslie enter the slum, and while Batman is distracted, Leslie is attacked. Batman flies off the handle, and Leslie has to remind him that it won't help to beat her attacker to death. Just then, Long John Logan shows up and offers to care for Leslie. Renewed by Leslie's faith and Long John's sacrifice and conversion, Batman realizes that sending something through the air ducts could incapacitate all the people in the building. He rushes to the roof and is able to stop Maxie's gang from dumping poison gas down the ventilation shaft. We close as Batman sends a warning to Maxie Zeus, and as Long John says, he will be sticking around to help Leslie. I guess there really is still hope in Crime Alley. The end. Captain Entropy, what did you think of The Curse of Crime Alley?
Well, I've telegraphed how I feel about this story. This is one of my favorite stories of all time, and especially one of my favorite Batman stories of all time. The thing that jumps out at you when you look at the splash page, and is true all through the book, is that Don Newton and Dan Adkins did an amazing job with the art. It's better than photo. There's just enough style and mood that I would rather have this than almost a live action version, right? The writing is great. This is 70s writing with these purple prose captions. And there's a lot of this stuff I did not understand in 1979, but you know, I read it many times and eventually I did. And it wasn't over the top. It's artistic, but it's, you know, it doesn't make you roll your eyes when you read it, really, at least not for me. The message that you talked about in the recap, that was a spot on description. On some level, he refers to Leslie Tompkins as a saint. This idea of he's supposed to be more about saving people than he is about revenge, and really not about revenge, but about justice. She's held up as kind of a Christian icon without them saying that in so many words. You see Long John Logan's redemption, and then they're fighting a guy who considers himself a pagan god. So the imagery is pretty perfect.
Bat Cousins, you can be very happy that Captain Entropy is on this podcast because he sums it up wonderfully and I don't have to go on and on and on and on about it.
You can always count on me to go on and on and on.
I think this story is phenomenal. I will bring up a couple of things. Teeny tiny nitpicks are nothing. The only kind of sort of question I have, and I guess definitely later on, wouldn't Leslie Thompson know Bruce is Batman? And is she just playing along the way Commissioner Gordon seems to enjoy playing along, that they can't figure this out? It has to be.
That's the one area. Batman shows up every year on the same night, the night the Waynes were killed, obviously. It's a bit of a leap of faith to take that people don't connect the two. Especially not Leslie, because she talks about it in the first story, too. She talks about it. Oh, I saw 20 years ago a brutal murder on this night. You know, that's just a little silly. Nobody figures that out. But I think we can give Denny O'Neill a pass on that, because later when he was editing the Batman books, he got smart and made Leslie a major character. And she, of course, was in the family and knew the secret and everything. I'll give him a pass on that. That's where I landed on that issue, Sean.
I will attempt a no prize on this.
Okay.
Honestly, I think it's a weak attempt because I think your points are good. But I think in her mind, Bruce is still 8 years old, and it's a hard thing for her to reconcile Bruce with who she sees as Batman.
Okay, that's fair. I'll buy that. So let's walk through. So the first scene of the muggers going after the old guy, I thought was pretty funny.
Oh, yeah.
and their reaction is like, oh, yeah, he's right. Oh, man, I all of a sudden I got a change of heart. They scamper off. I just think that's great. And then he meets up with Leslie. We get a 3-panel recap of Batman's origin, which is great, instead of a 3-issue miniseries on it. But how about the scene in the car? What do you guys think of that? I thought the art on that was pretty great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The rendition of the Barsky twins. I mean, the nice thing about Don Newton is his body types are all different. The faces are all different.
Yeah.
You can even tell, like, these guys are twins, but they have different hair. This car is going to come up in Gabriel's horn. But yeah, great.
I'm sure I've said it before, but Don Newton can give his characters such weight. You really feel that they have a physical presence, especially when the one twin goes through the window. Yeah. I love that.
That looks like it hurts. You know, on the network, we hear a lot how people think Jim Aparo's punches hurt, but that one where the guy's sailing through the windshield, that hurt.
The nice thing about those big land yachts is you can really draw back and get a swing going.
I want to draw attention while we're on that page. The bottom left panel is tremendous. You got Batman standing with his fist raised and a lightning bolt, and his face is like in shade. I'm like, wow, what a great panel.
Yep.
So then they figure out they have to go into the building, and then Batman recognizes that they're not police because they're carrying the wrong guns. Once again, that's not the super bat god, but he's still better than everybody else.
Right. Yeah.
I like that characteristic of Batman.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, just not assuming that they were police as soon as he saw the uniforms.
Right.
And looking for other signs. Of course, he probably doesn't see enough police presence in Crime Alley anyway. So maybe that helped him out.
Right. We get a little interlude with Maxie Zeus, who's still a pretty new character at this point. I think he's only had a couple appearances. I didn't look it up. But he, of course, is in a high rise named the Olympus.
Yes.
That's a nice touch. And he says, oh, it won't matter in a few minutes. We're going to take out the whole building.
I do think it's funny that he says, unless our friends at the weather service are mistaken, the happy event will occur within 15 minutes. That's a pretty accurate forecasting. And this isn't a Gabriel song, but for the 70s, nowadays you kind of can do like 15-minute increments, sort of. And even then, it's not great. But for back then, 15 minutes, that's pretty.
Well, maybe there's some sort of Thanagarian or Kryptonian technology on the DC Universe Earth where they can tell weather more accurately, you know? I don't know.
And again, that little nitpick does not take away from the story. Yeah. The story is fantastic.
So then there is a disturbing scene that we didn't talk about where Batman busts in on a man about to beat his wife. He stops them and the wife yells at Batman and tells him to get out and reconciled-ish with her husband. So that's a bit of a disturbing scene. Batman's like, you know, madness, other madness, he says.
That seems like a classic domestic disturbance situation you would expect regular beat cops to deal with. Denny O'Neill had a lot of social conscience, so I think he was just trying to show reality.
Yeah, no, I get it. And then we get the scene where Batman goes a little nuts. So talk about that, Captain.
Yeah, absolutely. So he realizes that while he was distracted, I guess this guy has knocked Leslie down and is taking her purse. He runs this guy down. So the purse snatcher immediately realizes that he's done the wrong thing, drops the purse, and is taking off at a full sprint. Not good enough. Batman slams him into the wall and starts kind of beating him and describing to him why this was a terrible mistake at the same time. Thank God Leslie stops him from doing the guy any permanent damage. And he even admits, Leslie says, beating him will do no good. He says, it'll make me feel better, which is probably the most childish thing I've ever heard Batman say.
Yeah, no. a great parallel from when he was a child and Leslie was there to comfort him, you know, so fantastic. So then he realizes about the gas. He runs up to the roof. Again, he uses the Batarang, still doesn't have the grapple gun like he does today, but is able to climb up to the roof. The rain has started and he takes out the guys on the roof as we would expect. Good action scene by Don Newton here.
One note on that climb to the roof and that just occurred to me now. He's climbing to the roof and that's supposed to be faster than the stairs.
I didn't understand that. It says the elevators are probably broken. The stairs may not go all the way.
Oh, that's right. Good point.
No. But I could understand the elevator, but how could the stairs not go all the way?
Maybe there's only one access to the roof. If he goes up the stairs, it'll end on the top floor. He doesn't know how to get to the roof. You're right that that was an acknowledgement that he thought of that, which is why you get the action scene of him throwing his rope up to the roof and going out the outside.
I've been in hotels where they will mark this stairway has roof access.
Okay.
But not all of them do. So maybe maybe there's only one stairway that has roof access and he doesn't know where it is.
He doesn't have time to figure it out. Yeah, maybe that's it. So he catches the gas, takes the guys down, and then he sends the old style Batman sending a message to Maxi Zeus soon with a little bat symbol under it. Love that.
Yes.
And we get the affirming scene at the end. Leslie's in the hospital recovering. She says, I'm a tough old bitty Batman. And there's John Logan there saying, I'm turning my life around. I'm going to help Leslie out at the clinic and in Crime Alley, make it a better place. Bless you both, she says at the end. Just good stuff all around.
Yeah, I agree. Terrific scene at the end with Long John saying he's going to take over some of her do-gooding while she's laid up. I thought that was terrific. The scene where Maxi is staring at the message in terror. Yeah, that really resonated with me because imagine you're trying to be a crime lord and Batman just lets you know, by the way, I know where you live.
I'm coming after you next. Yeah, I love it. So any final comments on the story? A classic, obviously. Had to be if it's in Sean's favorite digest.
And in some ways, I prefer this to the original.
I actually do too. I didn't read the original until many years later. It's more wrapped up with introducing who Leslie Tompkins is and why she's important to him. And this one is giving a message.
Okay, now we're going to move on to the Bat timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month, thanks to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. And this is January of 1979. And as always, we're going to start off with the Bat-related books. And the first one is The Aquateers Meet the Super Friends. And this was a giveaway that you got when you bought some swim goggles. And at the time, I did not know about this. I didn't know about this until it was reprinted in the hardcover Super Friends Saturday Morning Comics. In a way, I think I'm very glad I didn't know about this because I probably would have bid on this on eBay. And I would have been dismayed to find that of the 10 pages in this story, only 2 pages our brand new Super Friends. The rest is an Aquaman reprint. And Rob, I love Aquaman, but I would have probably paid 20, 30, 40 bucks for this, but I'm not going to pay 20, 30, 40 bucks for an Aquaman reprint. No offense. With 2 new Super Friends pages. It's definitely a fantastic bonus for the hardcover. Like, that definitely adds to that. And it's worth seeking out if you're interested.
Next up, we have Batman number 310. It's got an awesome Joe Kubert cover, which was not all the time on Batman, obviously, versus the Gentleman Ghost gives Kubert a chance to draw like a stagecoach and he's firing at Batman. Great stuff.
Yeah, I had this one. It's great.
And then there's Brave and the Bold number 149. And this one is Batman and the Teen Titans. And what's cool about this, you got a great Jim Aparo cover and it's a Bob Haney, Jim Aparo story. Of course, this is in between the cancellation of the Teen Titans that we talked about last year, the Bob Rozakis Teen Titans, and the new Teen Titans, which will come about a year or so from now in 1980. This, I think, was the only Teen Titans appearance in 1979. And so that's pretty cool.
Yep. But this was my introduction to the Teen Titans.
Yeah. And there's no Gabriel Saorn or anything. So it's obviously on Earth B.
That's why I don't ever want to visit Earth B. If they don't have a Gabriel Saorn, I'm not going. The next title is Justice League of America number 165. And the title of that story is A Mother of Magic. It's a great, fantastic cover. And it's great because it has Superman, Batman, Green Arrow, and Green Lantern. And they're all attacking their people that are coming after them. And it's, Superman says, great Krypton, my opponent is a stone statue. Batman says, mine is made of wood. And Green Arrow says, These warriors are phonies. Where are our real foes? The next one is Super Friends number 19. And that is The Mystery of the Missing Monkey. And it's fantastic because it has Wonder Woman riding a kangaroo who has jewels coming out of its pouch. And then Superman is going after a mountain lion. And Batman's reaching for an eagle that's taking some money. So that's fantastic. And the next one is The World's Finest, number 256. And that, of course, is Superman and Batman in The Werewolf of Krypton. It also has Green Arrow with Encounter with a Dark Avenger, Black Canary, The Night the Cry Failed, Hawkman, Prey of the Harpies, and Captain Marvel, Shazam, The Gamester's Death Wager. The cover has Superman flying into this crimson, pinkish demon coming out of a mirror. And Batman is like, what? Batman has kind of like a sassy pose for what's going on.
Yeah, so I had this one too. It's part of a two-parter. Well, first, the Captain Marvel story is great. It's kind of a fair play mystery done very well. But the two-parter World's Finest story with Kryptonian lycanthropy, great Murphy Anderson art, terrific.
Captain, obviously, I know what this means, but you said a fair play mystery. For the Bat Cousins who might not know, and I know what this is, but for Bat Cousins who don't know what a fair play mystery is, like me, what is a fair play mystery? I don't know.
I have to give credit where it's due. There was a recent Fire and Water podcast on the Maze Agency comics, which I wasn't even familiar with until Fire and Water covered it. But one of the big things about the Maze Agency was they were all fair play mysteries. So I think I'd heard this term before, but they refreshed my understanding, which is that the reader or the viewer, depending on how you get the story, has all the clues that he or she needs in order to solve the puzzle. And so an example of a mystery that isn't a fair play mystery occurs to me from the first story of this issue. Batman tells you he spotted that the cops weren't really cops because they were carrying the wrong sidearms. Yeah, you don't actually get to see the sidearms.
Yeah. So that's,
that's a counterexample.
So what else is on your list, Captain?
Do you really want me to go through this? Because
absolutely.
Okay, because this is like two dozen comics.
All right.
Starting off, the very first one, Action Comics 494.
Yeah.
Superman is busting in. And it looks like Lois is about to be murdered by the ghost of General Patton, or at least somebody dressed like that.
Yes.
It's unbelievable, that cover. I mean, yeah. Jose is all over the place this month with his covers. This is fantastic.
Yeah, I don't think he slept. Whatever month ahead of January.
Yeah, this was on my list too.
Yep.
I want to go read this issue now because I'm just looking at this cover.
Lois looks terrified, but other than that, she looks great in this cover. Amazing Spider-Man number 191. It has a Spider Slayer on the cover. That's really all I need.
One thing that's of note of this issue is that this cover of Amazing Spider-Man 191 is by Al Milgrom, who has now moved over to Marvel, you know, no longer associated with DC, obviously. He's already been employed by Marvel and doing covers of their flagship title.
Yeah, and he also edited at least one of the stories in this book. Let's see, from there, Avengers number 182. I didn't see this in the wild, but when I looked into it on Mike's Amazing World, it's a John Byrne Avengers story, so that's a yes. Captain America number 232 has Cap with Peggy Carter and Sharon Carter, and they're fighting modern-day Nazis, National Force, so that's a win. Conan the Barbarian number 97. I'm not normally a Conan guy. At least I wasn't then. I mean, I've read several stories I really enjoyed since then. Mm-hmm. But this has an amazing John Buscema cover with Beelit on it. And 6.5 or not 6.5, this would have gotten my attention.
That's a great cover. And this is building up to her death in 100.
Oh, wow. So I didn't know that. Daredevil number 158 is a Frank Miller Daredevil. Has a great cover where he's in a cemetery. And somebody who basically looks like the shadow is jumping out at him. I can't remember this bad guy's name.
That's not just a Frank Miller Daredevil cover. That's the first. This is the first issue of Daredevil done by Frank Miller. I did not have it, but that one puts set you back a pretty penny these days.
I do have a copy of this. I don't think in the condition mine is in, I'm going to make any money off of it.
Understood completely.
DC Comics Presents number 8 has Swamp Thing and Solomon Grundy. And Swamp Thing has Superman and what looks like a full Nelson while Swamp Thing is getting ready to give him the Captain Kirk double punch. And I think that's a JLGL cover too. Anytime Swamp Thing was interacting with the regular superheroes, I wanted to see it just because the juxtaposition was interesting.
Yep.
Yep.
So moving down, you'll be happy to hear we actually made it out of the D's. Moving on to Ghost Rider, number 35. I probably wouldn't have bought this at the time. Ghost Rider was like a maybe, but I just want to mention it because the Long Box Crusade guys did a great review of this, a hilarious review of this on Crusader Chronicles, what's now called the Amazing Spider-Man Chronicles, if you ever get a chance to listen.
Cool.
Godzilla, number 21. Godzilla is fighting Devil Dinosaur. That's, again, that's like the Spider Slayer on this cover. That's all I need. I know, back cousin Paul, your theory about gold key. There were a couple gold keys that I would have had to at least pick up and look through. And if it was a buy or no buy, they would have been a buy. The first one is this Grimm's Ghost Stories, number 49. It's just an amazing cover with this British officer from the Indian colonial era, this South Asian dancer woman, this bearded guy. It looks like it's painted. This other guy who looks like death. I don't know what is going on in there, but I would have wanted to find out.
That's the way those things work. It's like, what the heck is going on? And oh, that wasn't very interesting.
Yeah, probably so. So same deal with DC House of Mystery. Again, not normally a House of Mystery guy, but this is an amazing Mike Kaluta cover where a guy's walking out of the surf carrying a mermaid, and it's really gorgeous.
Yeah.
Invaders number 39. I can't remember this guy's name. Who's the bad guy on this? U-Man, I think.
I think it's U-Man or UFO, something like that.
I'm a sucker for the Invaders. Any World War II hero story, Invaders, All-Star Squadron, Justice Society, whatever. That looks great. Iron Man number 121. It's early Bob Layton Iron Man. And Bob Layton's actually my neighbor down here in Central Florida. We were at a con one year and I got to meet him. Great guy. I always enjoyed his work. Moving down, you already covered the Justice League. Oh, we're moving to the end. Settle in. Marvel premiere number 40. First appearance of Scott Lang, Ant-Man. I have it. It's great.
Also John Byrne.
Yes. Also not in good condition. Marvel Super Action number 13 is a reprint of Captain America number 111. And they kept this amazing Jim Steranko cover. I love it.
That great one on my list too.
I'm going to jump in because that was on my list because I have a glass that has cover image on it. A friend of mine, Kayla, was at Walt Disney World. They had it there. She brought it back for me and it is glass with that cover image.
That is cool. I've never seen that before, Sean.
Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap this up pretty quickly then because I've got to get to Disney World. It's not far here.
You're talking to kindred spirits.
Marvel Treasury Edition featuring the Fantastic Four, number 21. Beautiful Bob Budiansky cover of Galactus coming down and Fantastic Four fighting him. That would have been an easy pick. I'm actually showing some restraint, I promise you.
Okay, man, take your time. It's all good stuff. Most of these are on our list, too.
I was going to say, yeah, you're saving us time, really.
All right, cool, good. Marvel 2-in-1, number 50. This is another John Byrne issue. The Thing battles the Thing. He goes back in time to force himself to drink a serum that will cure him. This was just a terrific issue. I don't know how many times I read this.
This is one of my favorite Fantastic Four-related stories. He doesn't realize he's going to create an alternate timeline and he won't be affected. Fantastic, poignant. And in the same month, we get number 51, apparently, which is The Poker Night. Two different stories in Marvel 2-in-1, which was really an excellent title back in the day. Yeah. You get 100% concurrence with me on MTIO number 50, Captain.
Yeah, I will co-sign all of that. And they came back eventually to that timeline and visited that thing.
In the last issue, number 100, yep.
So Master of Kung Fu number 75. I was kind of an idiot when I was 6.5, so I wasn't reading Master of Kung Fu. This was the Mike Zeck era, and the Paul Galassi and Mike Zeck era, they were both fantastic. I have read the story since then. I would certainly pick it up knowing what I know now. Men of War number 15. I've kind of glossed over. There's a lot of war comics in this, and this is where I've been showing restraint, but this is a gorgeous Joe Kubert cover, and it's a Gravedigger story, and I never read a Gravedigger story, and I always wanted to, so this would be my way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This was winter. We happened to be living in Minnesota that year, so I think my parents just needed to keep me busy, and they were willing to spend money to do so. So I have a number of these books, like I've said, but I also have several of the Richie Riches and the Archies.
Yes. Yes.
Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. It's an issue where he's fighting Carrion, which was terrific. Moving down to Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, number 250. Mm-hmm. Who can pass up an anniversary issue?
Mm-hmm. Great cover. Oh, I'm a sucker for those covers where they smash out of other comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Love that.
Yeah. Well, I used to stare at them and try to see what can I learn about the other comic books from those covers. I had Superman number 334, where it looks like there's somebody in a purple jumpsuit whose head is an eyeball who is using heat vision against Lana. And Superman is on one knee complaining about the fact that he has lost his eyes to this monster. Finally, and I'll shut up after this, a crowd pleaser is going to be Warlord number 20. There is a demonic looking villain, Warlord, a cute little kid, and three beautiful barbarian women on this cover. And yeah. It's just Mike Grell goodness. So yep.
Drawing people without a lot of clothes on.
So. Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, I'm surprised you didn't pick What If number 14, Captain. What if Nick Fury fought World War II in outer space? I mean, for me, I was very literal with the what ifs when I was a kid. And I liked the ones that hinged on a certain moment, like number one, where Spider-Man decided to stay and talk to Fantastic Four and change the Marvel history. This one was a little wacky because it was like a totally alternate timeline. It's more like the modern what ifs that are parallel Earths. It's a fun story, but I was pretty literal back in the day when I was a kid. And I don't think I enjoyed this one quite as much as others.
I think they were still figuring out the format because, like you said, it didn't hinge on a point in Marvel history. If I remember right, it hinged on a point in real history and said, what if Leonardo da Vinci had actually invented all these things he designed?
Yeah, exactly. I think there was something going on, like Roy Thomas started it and then he got huffy and left the title. And that's why things were wacky for a while. I only have two other things to mention, Sean. The one is, just as a historical note, Battlestar Galactica number 2. We missed number 1, was in the off month, you know, in between the last issue of Detective and this one. I enjoyed these. I enjoyed the show. I don't know. How about you guys? Any history with Battlestar Galactica?
No, I was not a Battlestar Galactica kid.
Okay.
I got more into the second series, like the remake.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where lots of my fellow geeks loved it and I clearly missed out.
And then the last one I have to say is, hey, this is January 1979. We got Happy Days number 1. Happy Days ran from 1974 to 1984. This is right in the heyday of Fonzie and the crew. You got Happy Days from Gold Key. I don't recall if I had this. I don't think I did. I was probably over Happy Days at this point, but that is another historical note that I had to bring up. Sean, do you have any left after all that?
I do. So normally we go in alphabetical order, but I will save one for last. I did have DC Comics Presents with Swamp Thing. I also have Laugh Comics Digest because we need a digest. And that, of course, is the Archie characters. Marvel Super Action, which was Captain America, had the two Marvel Treasuries. The only thing I want to say about that is last year I got Marvel Treasury number 21, which was the Fantastic Four edition. This year I got number 20, which is the Hulk edition. Mm-hmm. And yeah, what was going on with Marvel, like double publishing that month?
I think some of them were late from the prior month or something. They had a lot of deadline problems at that time. So I don't know why they'd have two of several different titles had two this month. So it's weird.
And then, of course, I have Spider-Woman 13 and 14. And mm-hmm. Spider-Woman 13 has a great image with the Shroud. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, the Shroud. I had Superboy and the Legion 250, which I didn't have at the time. But I'm going back as I go to dollar bins. I'll get old Superboy and the Legion, so I'll work on that collection. My second to last choice is Walt Disney Showcase number 49, because it has the North Avenue Irregulars, which is such like a dumb, funny movie. Now, my last one. So normally I would not really get this. Mad Magazine was fantastic. And I would get Mad quite a lot. And then the other two were like Crazy and Cracked. And of the two, I think Crazy was probably better than Cracked. I had to be like jonesing for something to get Cracked because I didn't like Cracked. Crazy was okay. But the reason I am this month getting Crazy Magazine number 48 is because they have a parody of The Wiz, which means that I get to say, when I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing.
Sean, I think we ought to ease on down the road to see how many Richie Riches we had this month.
Not only are we going to say that there are 9 Richie Rich comics, because we always give the count, and 9 is a good number, we are going to tell you that it's Richie Rich, Richie Rich and Dollar the Dog, Richie Rich and His Girlfriends.
Otherwise known as Richie Rich and the Gold Diggers, right?
I get that reference, and I don't think a lot of people are going to get that. Richie Rich Billions, Richie Rich Fortunes, Richie Rich Jackpots, Richie Rich Millions, Richie Rich Riches, and Richie Rich Zillions with a Z. Because it's zillions with a Z, not zillions with an S, because zillions with a Z goes z, not s.
Yeah, I guess it was the winter lull with only 9 this month, right? So
I think the Archies and the Disney were taking up some of the newsstand room this month. There were a lot of those, too.
Yeah.
All right, now let's really ease on down to the road, Sean, to the human target, which I know you're chomping at the bit to get to.
I love the human target. Our next story is the Lights, Camera, Murder contract, and it stars the human target. 8 pages. It was written by Len Wein, penciled by Howard Chaykin, inked by Dink Giordano, and it was never reprinted. And in case that didn't come across in my line reading, I am shaking my fist in the air. Christopher Chance, the human target in the Lights, Camera, Murder contract. Hooray for homicide. Our tale has the best opening of any story ever seen in Batman Family. A musical chorus line with sequin footballs and a deadly pineapple. From there, we go into a flashback telling of how movie star Brad Nail almost died twice from sabotaged stunt equipment. Christopher Chance goes undercover as Nail to find out who is behind the nefarious plot. Which one of the two suspects we're introduced to is the murderer? We'll get to that in the synopsis. Captain Entropy, you better tread carefully, man. What did you think of this story?
No worries, Sean. I am safe. I really enjoyed this story. It was basically 70s TV action adventure. But on top of that, Christopher Chance's frustration and almost disgust with all the Hollywood types.
I know. I love that part of it. That's the best part, Captain. I agree.
What did you think of it, Paul?
Oh, I enjoyed it. It's a change of pace. It's funny because I love Howard Chaykin, big fan of his, especially in the 80s with the American Flag and others. We've been talking about Dick Giordano all along. And together, I felt that this was just kind of okay. I mean, it was good. Chaykin is kind of scratchy. Dick Giordano is so smooth.
Yeah.
And so I don't think they're the best combo, but it doesn't take away from the enjoyment of it. It just doesn't stand out as the best effort for either one of them. And I have a question for you, Sean. Were all the human target stories told in the first person? I haven't gone back and read because I know he's in Action Comics. I haven't looked at his whole history there.
Yes. I did my equivalent of research,
which was
printing out all of the character appearances from Mike's Amazing World. Around the pandemic, I actually think before the pandemic, I started collecting all of the human target stories because I knew they weren't going to be collected, but they should be. So this was the 11th appearance of the human target. And technically, this would have been the first story I read, but I actually remember next issue's story much, much more. It's much more cemented in my mind. So I'm not exactly sure why. And I did always like the character, which is a little surprising to me because back then it was pretty much all superheroes. Like if I'm getting a comic book, I'm getting a superhero. So for me to like a regular person like this, I can't figure out why I like the human target. Back then I couldn't figure out why. I don't even know if I can figure it out now. If people don't know, the human target is Christopher Chance. He disguises himself as people who are marked for murder. So he is a human target. The TV show that they made about it, I actually think improved upon that idea. So in the TV show, someone was marked for murder and Christopher Chance would put himself close to that person to figure out, which obviously opens up your story possibilities because all of these people who are marked for murder are pretty much going to have to be like 6 foot or 5'10 or 5'11 and basically have the same body type as Christopher Chance. He disguises his voice, he puts on makeup and all of that. But even so, I love these stories. So it started off in Action Comics and the first appearance was December 72, the cover date. And that was the Assassin Express contract, Action Comics. They're all from Dick Giordano. And it's funny, you were talking about the artwork. I like Howard Chaykin. He has such a great graphic style. And like you were talking about together, I don't think that they're great. So he was in Action Comics for, I guess, like 9 issues. Then the human target moved over to the Brave and the Bold as part of the DC Explosion. And then he was there for 2 months. And then after the implosion, he moved to Detective Comics. He has a bunch of appearances there. So he only has 21 appearances, although 2 of those appearances, one of them is in Detective Comics 500. I love that issue. But that issue, when it has like all the regular detectives, none of them really get a real chance to shine. And he doesn't dress
more like cameo, more like a cameo. Yeah.
And then also Crisis on Infinite Earths 11, he appears in, and I know he doesn't disguise himself as pariah to avoid him. But they kind of basically are, quote unquote, the same. It's the exact same plot device. It starts off in the middle of the action. It flashes back to how he met, and then it picks up, which is very common in Batman family. But this story is great because it starts off knee deep in the action. He's in the chorus line. He sees a hand grenade coming towards him. The director is partially Busby Berkeley and partially Ken Russell. So that's fantastic.
Who I had to look up. But I thought it was great that this is the second story in the book where they're not talking down to 6.5-year-old little cat me at all.
Yeah.
I mean, this could have been a TV movie and you wouldn't have had to change the dialogue. It's probably smarter than some of the dialogue in TV movies at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then it flashes back to Christopher Chance going to a movie studio. He meets Brad Nail. Brad takes him out to lunch and they go to Taco Bell.
I think that's hysterical. Yes. Chance is such a snob about it. He's like, you're kidding, right? You don't seriously intend to eat here?
Although I will say, at that point, I guess Taco Bell was a fast food restaurant, but it would have been a fast food restaurant in California. In Pennsylvania, we didn't get Taco Bells until well into the 90s.
Well, and they don't actually name it, but it's just hysterical.
Well, they call it Taco King, and yeah. Above that, there is the Taco Bell logo.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is they drive 45 minutes to get to Taco Bell. Nail really wants to eat there.
I was thinking, but it's LA though. So LA traffic, a 45-minute drive could be like 5 miles. So yeah, that was a dig at LA traffic, maybe?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Christopher Chance says, he supposed he'll survive eating this food, although he doesn't know if my digestive system will ever be the same. Brother, I understand. Nail, who probably really modeled after Burt Reynolds with that mustache and kind of like an action movie.
Stunt guy, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Obviously today, movie stars don't do their own stunts or anything. But compared to today, I think it's kind of more like a Tom Cruise, how he makes such a big deal that he's doing his own stunts. So I kind of think that's part of this Brad Nail persona.
Yeah, maybe.
But one thing I want to point out, which I do think is hard to understand, he's telling Christopher Chance that he's had two accidents. That is pictured, but for the longest time, I didn't understand that these were two different things. He is hang gliding and he's jumping out of a car. I thought this was like one image of like a great.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see why you're confused.
Yeah, no, these are two different. I wish they would have been colored differently or something.
Yeah.
But that's how we get that two different accidents have happened previous to this. That's called foreshadowing.
Yeah.
That's called foreshadowing a fair play mystery. We see Christopher Chance put on the stages of his makeup. And it is funny because he says, Brad Nail makes enough money to afford me. Brad shows up on set and he hears the heart-stopping voice belonging to Jessica Kincaid, the fire-breathing head of Olympic. And Olympic is movie studio. But I also think it might have something to do with Maxi Zeus. Maybe he's funneling money into it. So she says, just because I'm paying you twice what you're worth, don't think you're indispensable. 5 minutes more and I'd have sent Pinky on in your place. Mm-hmm. Now we find out that Pinky was the hot young star before Brad Nail came in. And for all of my fellow gay viewers, that is All About Eve. It's Showgirls. There's always someone younger and prettier on the stairs behind you. So Pinky used to be the hot shot guy, but now Brad is taking over. But the thing is, at a certain point, when you're a stuntman, you know you're going to age out of being a stuntman. Then it catches us back up to the current time in the story where Brad Nail, Christopher Chance, is in the chorus line and he sees this hand grenade coming at him.
Instead of a football, you need to point that out.
Instead of the sequin.
Everybody else got a sequined football. Yes. And he got a grenade.
I can't believe I forgot.
Football. I missed that.
Oh, yeah. So on the first page it says, and I, Lord help me, was part of the chorus line wearing white tuxedo, helmet, and cleats, expecting to intercept a sequined football. But that's not what I got. Not by a long shot.
There's two other footballs on either side of the grenade there, Cap.
Okay, all right. Well, I guess what I need is some 21st century coloring here.
So our story picks up. The hand grenade is coming right towards him. So, of course, he takes off his football helmet, catches it in the football helmet, and then throws it into a waterfall, which was a prop on the set. So that saves him, although it does kaboom. Now, luckily, they caught that on screen. So Christopher Chance runs after to see what's going on, but he's stopped by Ms. Kincaid. They're talking. She's like, hey, I don't know what you're doing, but this is the third time that an accident has been brought against you. You almost lost your life three times. We can't have this. One more time and you're through. And then Christopher Chance says, So we know that probably means nothing. And then there's another fantastic Busby Berkeley kind of musical setup where it's a carnival where you have the rifles and, you know, you shoot things over and they fall over. But what's happening is a real rifle is being pointed at Christopher Chance. And he's like, oh, I got to get out of here. So there's this big spring. He springs up into the catwalks and finds Pinky there with a gun. Pinky's the murderer. So Christopher Chance takes a sandbag and throws it over. It misses Pinky, but what swings one way swings the other way. So the sandbag hits Pinky. Pinky falls. Did Pinky die? No, Pinky didn't die. The ambulance
I don't think he's dead.
Captain Entropy, it's not that much of an adult story.
So yeah, right.
The ambulance is coming, and then Jessica Kincaid says, that last stunt was the final straw. You're through here. And then Brad Nail, who's really Christopher Chance, says, then that makes two of us, Ms. Kincaid. And she's like, your voice, it sounds different. And he says, and with good reason. I'm not Brad Nail. The name is Christopher Chance. And then, I do love this story, but he says, I don't know why, Ms. Kincaid, but you hired Pinky to kill Brad Nail. No one else knew how many accidents there'd been. By the way, we were not told that he didn't
this
know.
This is not fair play, Sean.
But yeah, so Captain Entropy introduced me to something I kind of already knew but didn't have a name for it. So thank you for this is an unfair play mystery.
Yes.
And then she's like, I had to. The auditors are coming next week. They'll discover I forged Nail's signature to a fortune in phony checks. I promised Pinky he'd replace Nail if he killed him. If Nail were dead, he couldn't deny that the checks were his. That's a lot of confectioning in the second to last panel of the story. I would think Jessica should have just shut up because maybe she could have gotten away with something or a lesser sentence or something. I do love the story and I love the human target. So Bat Cousins, I'm not going to say if you love the human target, because you love the human target, be sure to tell me why.
I love the human target because this is an 8-page story. There are 3 named characters who are not the human target, and 2 of them are the murderer or the attempted murderer. Right. There's no twist. There's no misdirect. They don't have time to give you all the clues and make it a fair play mystery.
I think the twist, Captain, was supposed to be that it was both of them, because it's hard to do it in an 8-page story. We talked about it on that podcast. That was even hard to do it in one issue. Like, yeah, if you watch a movie or a TV show, you've got 40, 50, 80 minutes, right? Whereas if you have a 17-page comic, it's hard to do. 8 pages is even harder yet. It's tough to hide or put a clue or red herrings in 8-page mystery story. He ought to stick to action and worry less about the mystery.
He is technically, I guess, a detective because he has to figure out. But yeah, it does make more sense for these stories to be in Action Comics than Detective Comics. That will not stop my love for Christopher Chance, the human target. And I'm glad we're going to get to talk about him a lot more times in the future.
His whole shtick is, when they try to kill me thinking I'm their target, then I'll catch them and stop them. This is an incredibly dangerous business model. It's very much Action Comics.
No wonder this was not a franchised operation.
Yeah.
So we're in agreement that this is the best story in this issue, beating the first story. Okay, great.
Negative.
So we will move on to the third story, which is probably better even than the first two. The next story is A Date with Batgirl, starring Batgirl. It's 12 pages, written by Bob Rozakis, but this is the last story as writer of Batgirl. The penciler is Robert Oskner, and the inker is Vince Coletta, and this was later reprinted in Batgirl, the Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 2 hardcover from 2019. A Date with Batgirl. Our story begins at the Lincoln Memorial, as Batgirl tries to stop the SAE. After some great action, Batgirl stops them, but not before hearing a clue to their next target. After they are taken away, a soldier asks Batgirl out on a date. Whilst, I put that in for Martin, whilst on the outing, after dealing with being a celebrity, Batgirl's date mentions the Washington Monument, which makes Batgirl realize that that is the next location. After confronting the SAE and more great action, Batgirl's date resumes with a late night walk around Washington, D.C. Captain Entropy, tell us why this story is better than the first two stories combined.
Well, I can't do that, but I'll tell you why it was a great story.
Okay.
The Bob Oxner art is amazing. The terrorism angle, and this is very 70s terrorism, but I'll save the details maybe for Gabriel's Horn. And really, what I loved about it is it's showing Batgirl as a human being and what would happen if she went out on a night on the town in costume. And you have a U.S. Army soldier, and as a military veteran, he is portrayed as just a decent, normal guy. I'll take any positive portrayal I can get.
I like it too, Captain. It's a cute story. Oxner, he draws attractive people. He's a little stiff on the action, but miles better than Don Heck. A lot of butt shots.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. You know, I got to wonder about the soldier if Bob had continued. We talked last month, Sean and I did, about Bob moving out of writing Batgirl and Robin because of the consolidation at DC and everything. You wonder if this guy was intended to be a permanent love interest, permanent as things get. Well, you know, obviously never know. It was fun, just cute all around. And Sean, you're going to tell us why we should like it even more?
No. Okay. The last story I said about how I printed out the Human Target's character appearances and he started off in action. I kind of think this story would make me think more that Batgirl was an action character, because I like the action in this story a lot. The detecting? Oh boy.
Yeah.
It's a stretch.
Oh my God. That quote unquote clue? Holy moly.
Maybe it should be, instead of Detective Comics, Guessing Comics.
Yeah. This is Riddler quality super detection on the part of somebody in a bat costume.
I think Riddlers are great, and this is horrible. This is a lot of times when I drop something and no one understands what it is because it's not well thought out. So you think I'd be more sympathetic to it, but no. So the story starts off at the Lincoln Memorial. By the by, if you've never been to the Lincoln Memorial or like those sites in DC, you might think it's going to be boring, but no, they are really, really cool to go and see, make a day and a weekend of it. They are really, really great. Having said that, I think Bob Oxner was probably working maybe off of photo reference, because there are people on Lincoln's leg. You could probably fit 20 people on Lincoln's leg instead of just this one guy. The Lincoln Memorial is huge, and there's like one guy on his leg. No, 20 people would
fit. I like the guys peeking out from behind his legs on the ground.
However, I do think that's a great, all these guys shooting their guns at Batgirl as she's swinging in.
I got to jump in before I forget. I once ran into Adam Kubert and his kids at the Lincoln Memorial.
Wow, that's weird. That's funny.
And recognized him because I'd seen his photo. Sorry, go ahead.
No, really, that's cool. That's great. Yeah, so they're shooting at Batgirl. And Batgirl, and I do like the action, but it's kind of like Batgirl, I think, is just swinging back and forth, which I...
You think they could have gotten a bead on her.
At first, you think she's swinging in. I think the splash page on this, I think it's great. I think it's...
Yeah, splash page is good, yeah.
But you think she's going to swing in and like start kicking them, but I really think she's just swinging back and forth. But then eventually, she throws some gas pellets to take them out. Then she swings in and kicks the guy in the face. Then she punches the other two. I love it when superheroes really like super kick people, because I kind of think I could kick. I don't know about throwing a punch, but I think I could kick. And I probably could kick. I could probably kick up to my head. So wow. I like anytime I see kicking. She gets five of them, but one of them gets away. And then Batgirl says, weren't there six of them? One of the soldiers says, good Lord, you're right. And one of the bad guys says, blame straight, sister, she's right. Our fearless leader has made his getaway to live and fight another day. And I'll lay you odds you won't find out our next target till it's too late. And then some other guy says, yeah, 16-1 odds. Shut your mouth, creep. So amazingly, that's an important detail in this story.
It stands out as a clue. So they did that part right. How you got to the next target from there, I don't know.
Amen, brother. This is stuck in Batgirl's crawl for the rest of the story.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, a soldier comes up. And man,
based on the shot of Batgirl at the bottom of page 5, I can see why he asked her on a date.
Yeah.
Is she holding her cape away so that he can get that shot?
She's the proto Nightwing of her day.
Yes.
No wonder they team up so well together.
Yeah.
But it is cute how the guy's sweating and he's like, oh, do you want to go out with me?
See, Batgirl's a superheroine, so she is a huge big deal. But I know for me, if a guy's gonna come up and like ask me out or proposition me or something, I want him to have somewhat swagger or self-confidence. That's a try. Not this.
I was wondering if possibly you would like to could you go out with me on a date?
I'm not so big on that. Now I do think it probably takes nerve for someone to ask a superheroine out on a date. Yeah. So I'll give him points, and I guess he's conventionally handsome, cute, I guess.
And here's the art was pretty good on this middle panels on page six is cute, where she's like, huh, I've gone out with lots of people as Babs, but nobody's ever asked me out on a date as Batgirl. What the heck? Why not? You're okay, yeah. Sergeant, you're on. I thought that was cute. I enjoyed that.
I like that part. Yes, I did like that part. And yeah, I guess it probably is something different. You know, you're out fighting crime. Someone asks you out. So that's cool. They agree to meet on the steps of the Capitol building. He gives her a corsage.
But she's like, it's lovely. And then thinking, it's rather ludicrous, but what can you do?
In the immortal words of Captain Entropy, we may be talking about this when we visit a disco in the future.
This story cracks me up.
So not talking about Gabriel's horn here, I just want to say he picked one that went with a costume. So I think points for that. And second, I think corsage on your costume should be code for superhero off duty and on date.
So he knows this cozy little restaurant near Ford's Theater where nobody will bother us. But of course, everybody bothers them. And she's signing autographs. And she's still thinking, though, about the incredibly great clue mystery of 16 to 1. One great thing is they talk about previous events with Madame Zodiac.
Yeah, yeah, he was there. I love that.
I didn't go back and look to see if you really can see it's him. My guess is no, but that's
okay.
So they talk about Madame Zodiac and the Pentagon. I do love Batgirl because she's like, if they want to investigate me, they can go right ahead. Yeah. Let them figure out just how much more damage there would have been if I wouldn't have been around.
Yeah. She's like, part. She's a very confident, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she's still thinking about the 16-1 odds. Meanwhile, there's a live band on base. So they go out dancing. His friends don't think it really is Batgirl. And then Batgirl proves it by flipping this guy over on his back. And I'm really glad about that because that guy was a jerk. But because she's spending so much time thinking about this clue, he thinks that she's quiet and standoffish because she doesn't even want to talk to him. He's in their car and he's apologizing to how everything turned out. He says, it's just that everywhere we go, we run into people who react to your costume. If only there were some place where there weren't any people around. Ha ha. We could go climb the Washington Monument. I bet there's nobody there. And then she says, of course, that's it. The Washington Monument. Oh my God. Batgirl figures out that the 16-1 odds means that the Lincoln Memorial, where they hit today, Lincoln was the 16th president. So they're going to the first president, which was the Washington Monument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know how the thug who was bragging, I don't know how he figured out what the other guy meant. And he knew what the target was.
I wish the soldier would have said, I'm really sorry about how tonight is turning out. It's just that everywhere we go, we run into people who react to your costume. If only there were some place there weren't any people around. Ha ha. We could go climb the Washington Monument and get Robin's rope from off of the top. Then this story would have been the greatest story in Batman Family Reunion history, but it's not.
Superhero scavenger hunt.
Good call there from 20 some episodes ago.
So instead, they rush towards the Washington Monument. They see that the bad guys are there and they're like, well, we don't want to damage the monument, so we'll let you go. So instead, they go back to the car and they ram the car right into the front door of the Washington Monument, which I don't know why they think that's not going to cause any damage. I guess the bad guys would have damaged the Washington Monument far worse than running a car into the front door.
That girl's all about comparative damage the whole night. I want to jump in here. This looks like a Datsun 280Z from the time frame. He's a staff sergeant in 1979 when there was double-digit inflation. All his money is in that car. He's got to love Batgirl that he agreed with this plan.
Yeah, he's showing out for Batgirl. That's absolutely true.
That's too funny.
It is great that he is a man of action. That's very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, he was very positively portrayed. I don't know, Captain, what do you think? They got a lot of military stuff in this one.
Well, so on the military side, and I'll talk about the uniforms when we get to Gabriel's Horn.
Okay, all right.
But I'll say now, he looks like a soldier. Some of the other guys back at the base look more like they were playing soldier dress up than they should have been on Welcome Back, Cotter. But this staff sergeant's hair is just barely within reg, so he's good. But other than that, he's clearly a military police type, working at the Pentagon, called in for the Lincoln Memorial. We have a lot of counterterrorism forces now that really started in the 80s, right after this, that we didn't have back then, an FBI hostage rescue team. And nowadays, you'd have basically a Rolodex full of people to call if something like that happened. But back then, the SWAT team from the Pentagon, sure, that makes sense.
That's cool.
The story ends up that his car, of course, is totaled because he ran it into the front door of Washington. And then they decide to take a nice romantic stroll back home. And I like that. I think that's really neat.
Yeah, very cute ending.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of nice places to walk in DC.
Yes. And Captain, there's no shame in admitting you wanted this issue for this story instead of the first one. That's completely fine.
Batgirl's terrific in this. I wouldn't have any problem at all admitting that. My priorities were different when I was six.
Okay, now we are going to move on to the Batmail family. But there's still no letters, and I guess we can say it's because of the merging. Instead, we get two text pieces, and normally that's cool, except the one on the front page isn't really great. It talks about 40 years ago, Detective Comics went on sale. It's taken 40 years for the mythology of Batman to develop. There have been 1,200 stories. It's been on TV. They don't really mention cartoons, which I think they should have. And then it says, now to celebrate the 40th anniversary, we return to this moment of his origin in a touching story by Denny O'Neill. In addition, we have tales showing the other side of Batman, which I guess is the dumb side of Batman.
The goofy side. We haven't got to that yet, John. Don't give away the last story in this episode. One of the things that I love about the front cover is it's dedicated to Bob Kane and Bill Finger, which you didn't see a lot of. This is 1979, so Levitz knows the score. When I read that, I'm like, oh, that's great. That's cool that Bill Finger gets a call out there, even though he, at the time, didn't get the credit he deserved, but great that he got the credit there. So I just wanted to mention that before you go into the back cover.
Yeah, so Mike W. Barr talks about Bill Finger.
He does, too.
Cover too, so they both covered him. I noticed that also.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and on the inside back cover, Mike W. Barr gives a much more detailed, and I like this one a lot more. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I guess this isn't on DC Universe Infinite. Like, I hate that they don't have the text.
They don't put the text pages on. Sometimes they have the table of contents page, the first one, but they won't have the back one. Weirdly, we'll get to it later. On DC Universe, they don't even have the final story, the kangaroo story. Well, we'll get to that later. That's just...
Although, I don't know. Maybe we do understand why that wasn't reprinted. One thing I do super really like about the text piece is it does call into practice the Batman family. It says it's home for the entire Batman family over the years. So that does make more sense into the merging. So there also is the statement of ownership, management, and circulation. And I remember seeing this when I was a kid and just ignoring it. It's this huge block of text.
See, I was the geeky one. I would always read the numbers in there. And
Bat Cousins, I tried doing it for you. And I started writing out how many issues were printed and how many were sold or returned. And then I got lost in numbers.
Well, the simple one is to just look at the first two numbers. There's more detail, but you say the average number of copies for the last 12 months was 367. That's how many were printed, the press run. Now, they weren't all sold. It was 367,000.
367, okay.
Right, and then the actual number of copies of the issue published nearest to the filing date, so last issue, say, was only 211.
2, 11.
So that just shows that over the last year,
156.
The circulation dropped. And so that's why the hope that the Batman family merging would increase sales. We'll see.
Okay.
Got my dollar.
Captain, do you have any thoughts on the text pieces?
I enjoyed both of them. I mean, I think the world of Paul Levitz is one of the first fans who made good and was both a great writer and executive running the business side. And Mike W. Barr's piece told me a lot of stuff I didn't know. So that was cool.
And one of the things we like is the nature of the anthology comic book, right? And he talks a lot in there, Mike W. Barr does, about the positive attributes of the anthology story. I mean, we've seen in just these three stories, three very different stories. I just think that's neat.
Yeah, I agree. One thing that I caught out of Paul Levitz's piece that really doesn't mean anything, but it was interesting to me, is that Detective Comics number 27 had 68 pages, and this comic has 68 pages.
That was cute, yeah.
That was nice. Yeah, that was really nice, yeah.
That was cool. All right, let's move on to our fourth story, starring the Demon in Return to Castle Brannock. It's a 10-pager written by Len Wein with art by Steve Ditko. And it has only been reprinted in the Steve Ditko Omnibus Volume 2. So we pick up where we left off last issue as the Demon turns to face the strange-looking Baron Time. By the way, listeners, that's T-Y-M-E.
You can hear it when you say it.
Okay. Baron Time has recovered the Eternity Book. Etrigan demands he return it to him, but Time is able to hold him off with a spell and claims to now be able to control the Demon since he has the book. Baron Time then very politely gives him and us a summary of his only previous appearance in Jerry Conway's Man Bat number 1 from 1975, which also had Steve Ditko art, where he had learned the dark arts and made a deal with a Hellspawn. Now, I'm not sure what the difference between a Hellspawn and a Demon is, but whatevs. Anyway, the Hellspawn was to provide him with human lives in exchange for power. In order to do that, he had possessed and transformed Francine Langstrom into a vampire She-Bat, or Fran-Bat, as Rob would say, to do his evil bidding. Kirk was only able to cure Francine and finally defeat him when he accidentally knocked over a mystical fire and Baron Time was thrown through a, quote, jagged rift in reality. But only halfway. He is stuck between two realities. That's why his right side appears as it did then, but his left side kind of looks like the Marvel being Eternity.
Mm-hmm.
He learned during his imprisonment that the only one who can free him from his torment is Merlin. So he devised the plan to steal the book and compel Etrigan to take him to Merlin's tomb. Etrigan resists, but the pain and power of the Eternity Book is too much. So the Baron opens a portal and he and the Demon return to Castle Brannock. Etrigan is sneaky, though, and walks around the courtyard in the, quote, pattern of power to juice up his mystical energies. They battle for a couple pages of Ditko weirdness when Baron Time plays his trump card. As he holds the Eternity Book, he says, "Vanish, vanish, Etrigan, return again, the form of man." Of course, the Demon reverts to Jason Bard, still in his shirtless workout outfit, to Sean's continued delight. Time stalks towards the tomb as Jason warns him that if he opens the tomb, he will unleash unimaginable peril. Ignoring him, the Baron shoves the lid off the tomb and looks in to find the tomb empty? To be continued. Whew. Captain, what did you think of Return to Castle Brannock?
I thought this is one of the best Doctor Strange, I mean, Demon stories I've ever read.
Oh, shady.
But seriously, this is a great Doctor Strange story. Etrigan is just filling in for him. Actually, going back over it tells me why I always kind of associated Etrigan with Steve Ditko art, even though he was a Jack Kirby creation. But I think he's kind of the perfect overlap of the two because he is mystical and you get to see all the Ditko weirdness,
yep,
like you talked about, even yep, though he was a Kirby creation, he's got that Kirby power.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. This Ditko art is very jarring after Michael Golden, but his weird style, I think, suits the Demon. I don't know. Sean, what are your thoughts about the story?
Back in 1979, I bet I didn't even read this. At the time, I thought it looked horrible, and I knew I liked Michael Golden. Now, in the interim years, I have read the entire original run of Spider-Man, so I absolutely have an appreciation for Steve Ditko. I like this a lot. Like, I really, really like this a lot.
Oh, now, yeah, this is terrific.
There is a Golden come down. The carryover of the Kirby portals and that kind of stuff, mm-hmm, like, it definitely carries through. And the story is super cool. I'm sure we'll get to it, but I love Vanish, Vanish, Etrigan, Return to the Form of Man. Like, I love that. I like this a lot.
It's a terrific story.
I liked this more than the Batgirl story.
Part one, we loved last issue. Part two, we liked this issue. You know, I agree with you. When I was a kid, I didn't like Steve Ditko either. This is, by the way, only about 17 years after Spider-Man. You think about that. It's ancient history now, right? But back then, not that long a time, you know? And he's still earning a living from drawing the demon. And little tidbit for both of you guys. What other character did Ditko follow Kirby on?
Oh, Machine Man.
Very good. Machine Man. That's right. I never knew that myself. I didn't buy Machine Man, but I had a complete Machine Man trade paperback a few years ago. And the first half is Kirby and the second half is Ditko. I'm like, whoa. Both energetic and wild and crazy in different ways. It's fascinating.
Always had a soft spot for Aaron Stack X51.
Yeah, there you go. So let's walk through. So you got the Baron where he's half and half. I went back and I reread that Man Bat number one on DC Universe, and it looks just like him, the left half of him, or his right half, I guess. But the left half is all black with stars in it, like Eternity, like I mentioned. I did think it's weird because I thought, oh, Len Wein, did he write Man Bat? And I went back and I looked, no, that was Jerry Conway. But of course, Jerry Conway with his buddy. So I guess he wanted to reuse that because it's been a couple of years since that story was out. So I thought it was odd, but what the heck.
And the other nice thing too is, in addition to when the Demon teamed up with Man-Bat, it does kind of cement Demon a little bit more into Batman family.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That's good. Yeah, that's fair.
Should Baron Time have had a guardrail or something around that brazier? Like, yes. A good safety inspection could have prevented this.
That's funny. Talk about Ditko weirdness. Bottom panel of page three. I really like that. There's a Doctor Strange looking panel there, if anything.
I like the melting pyramid in the right hand with eyes.
Yeah, I'm like, what is that? You know, that's wild stuff. Yeah, no, that's a great panel. I love that.
Below that, there's something with some really ominous teeth.
Oh, yeah, coming out of the dark. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one. He got his three supporting characters on page five.
And it's neat that there's a tie-in with Cobra.
Yeah, I had read Cobra years ago, but I don't remember. But I didn't realize this Randu was the same guy that was in that. So that's kind of neat.
While we're there, this is the oddly appointed Parker of demonologist Jason Blood. Yes. We just went over like three stories ago that Park Row is now Crime Alley.
Oh, and it says Park Row?
Oh, it does say Park Row, yeah.
Editor Paul Levitz didn't do a good job on that one, Captain.
Maybe this is the one nice apartment left and nobody messes with it. Because
maybe that's why he got such a giant apartment cheap. I don't know.
So two things. Is there an upper Park Row and a lower Park Row? Maybe. Or is it like Snoopy's doghouse where it looks like one thing on the outside, but it's so it looks dilapidated and run down outside, but inside it's...
Well, I love that he's got all these statues in there and Glenda is so casual about it. She just has her hand on his bust of his head.
So I do appreciate Steve Ditko, but the apartment does not compare.
The apartment does not compare. I'll agree with you there.
That was for Brett.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it looks like almost normal sized apartment in that panel on page five.
Well, but it has all the same clutter and furniture as when Michael Golden did it.
It is cluttered. So then we get to Castle Brannock and the townspeople are afraid because there's a storm coming. And then you see him again, bottom of page six. It's cool how they're jumping out of the portal.
Yeah.
Back in the townspeople, the constable here, Inspector Stavik, with his one arm. This is straight from Young Frankenstein, which I think was a lift from Bride of Frankenstein or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if he featured in Man Bat number one or not. And he's so obviously trying to distract these people from something that concerns him too. That's funny.
Yeah, that was good. Actually, I don't recall that. He could have been in the Demon, because this is now where the first issue of the Demon took place. And it's been a couple of months now since I read that. So I don't remember the inspector there. So then the Demon is hopping around to this dance of power, which is the pattern of power. Dance of power. The pattern of power, which I thought was kind of funny.
I like when he says, "an inebriated gargoyle."
Yeah. More impressive vocabulary for me to look up at six years old. But honestly, if you met a character like the Demon and he was making sure to hit certain stones and, you know, moving oddly, I would just assume that was him.
It makes sense. I guess he's a weird dude. Yeah. So then they have their mystical battle. A lot of Doctor Strange looking stuff on pages 8 and 9, Captain. I agree with you. Especially the bottom of 8.
Yeah.
And then he turns him back. Sean's favorite part. Vanish, vanish, Etrigan, return again in form of man. He turns back into Jason Blood, still in his workout clothes, which is great. And then the last page, he goes to, and that giant tomb that they're looking at, that does appear in the Demon number one, that I do remember. So that's pretty neat that they call right back to it. And he shoves it off and it's empty. Merlin's not in there. So now we have to wait and see what happens next issue. Great stuff. This is a great story.
Yeah. So while we were talking, I found my notes. So on story page two, panel two, Barentine's first word balloon, you cannot threat me, demon. There's no N at the end of.
Oh, yeah. The N got dropped off. You cannot threaten me. Sean, you are the expert at finding typos these days. Well done.
Although maybe it is old-timey, magical term. Maybe it is
You cannot threat me. You cannot threat me.
Like smite or something. You know, it's an old-timey word that no one uses anymore.
Okay.
Don't threat me, Paul.
I shan't.
Okay, we are now moving on to the fifth story, and that is Terminus. Starring Robin with a mystery guest. 10 pages written by Bob Razakis, and this is the last story as writer of Robin. The penciler is Kurt Schaffenberger, and the anchor is Dave Hunt. It's later reprinted in Batman Arkham, Joker's Daughter trade paperback from 2018, and Robin the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover from 2020. Robin in Terminus. A meeting of the criminal organization named Maze is underway, with special guest appearances by Raven, not that one, and the Card Queen. When the leader not only tells the gathered assemblage that he wants Robin dead, but also that he wants the director dead. Believing that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, Robin swings in and saves the director's life. A grand melee ensues, with all of the Maze agents being rounded up and captured, except for Raven, not that one. Robin and the Card Queen talk, and it's revealed that CQ was DD, Dula Dent in disguise. And then, in an unprecedented four-page Razakis recap, Dick Grayson reveals to Lori and all of the other students that Dave Corby had been Raven, not that one, all this time, decks him, and then walks alone into the sunset. What did you think, Captain?
I thought it was a really good story. There's a lot going on here. Robin looks great in it. He's doing great action. The introduction of Dula Dent when she's not wearing a ridiculous costume was awesome. The end is kind of a lot to take. I mean, Dick is the one who ends up beating the Raven, which I would think, according to everything I learned as a student of secret identities as a child, would point to him being Robin. And then he's kind of cold with Lori at the end and everybody else.
Yeah, I agree with all those points, Captain. I love this story. I love the fight at the Maze headquarters. I loved how Dula helps out. Everything falls together. Bob's obviously wrapping up his big Maze storyline. Doesn't seem as rushed to me as last issue's Batgirl story with the sign of Superman. I thought it was a satisfying conclusion. Dick humiliates Dave, but he's also, like you said, kind of mean to Lori. But you know what? She was so fickle to jump right to Dave. I thought it was a terrific ending to that saga, so to speak. Sean, how about you?
Yeah, I do like it. I don't love it. I do like that it doesn't feel like a typical story because you have all of that action right up front, and then you do have like that four pages at the end. And I like that it's like a little bit different. I do think one thing that doesn't help the story, I like Kurt Schaffenberger a lot. I think his art is clean. I think it's almost like an animated style, which for me is like a super big bonus. I just think it makes this story look not as important or you know, quote unquote, real or dramatic as it could have. And it's weird because I do like Kurt Schaffenberger a lot. I know he went on to New Adventures of Superboy and I'm collecting that entire run. And his Mr. and Mrs. Superman, I just think is fantastic. I just think with this story, and it's funny because I like the way Robin looks in it.
He looks younger, right? And we're getting used to, I mean, after looking at Don Newton's Robin. And,
right, yeah, that's what I was going to say, yeah.
It's a come down, right? He's a solid artist, a good storyteller. The layouts, you know, are fine. It's, you know, it's a little old fashioned. It's just a shame that this had to be on the last. But Don Newton was gone places. He graduated very quickly from Robin and Batgirl to Batman. And so that's, you know, we've seen that happen several times with Marshall Rogers and then with Michael Golden and now with him. So it's been interesting to see the migration of the talent, try them out on the backups. Them's the breaks when you're the teen wonder, I guess.
And I will have some redeeming artwork notices when we go through beat by beat. So the story starts off, and I was a little bit disappointed because it starts off with this huge screen, and I thought that was a TV screen, but apparently it's a static screen. It must just be a slide. Because a couple pages later, when you see the screen, Robin is in that exact same pose.
You're right. It's funny. I didn't notice that.
He tells him to shoot the picture.
I wanted it to be a big jumbotron, but it's just like when you watch slides.
It's a giant microfiche reader.
Yeah. But it is neat because they're bringing the end in. And here, the big director of Maze talking about how Raven and Card Queen, you both failed. But ultimately, it's the director's fault. He's like, ooh. He's pulling his collar and doing like, oh. They're going to kill him. But Robin swoops in. And what does Robin do? He kicks. I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. I think that's fantastic. Ka-chunk. He's kicking the gun right out of the guy's hand. So he saves the director.
Yeah, and then Robin touts the new band of Lieutenant Rick Tatum and the New Carthage Police Department.
No. I will see your band and I will raise you one. You know how in the musical variety specials in the 70s, it feels like, I heard you were having a party, and so I brought along some friends. Lieutenant Rick Tatum and the New Carthage Police Department.
Yay! Before we get too far past it, I want to call back to the page before, because
yeah, sure.
This is not a Gabriel's Horn moment. I'm going to introduce a new segment to the show called a speakeasy moment. Because the director, I didn't realize because this was the first issue I actually owned, but the director's a dead ringer for Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. apparently this has anti-communist overtones. In addition to that, the guy who's about to kill him must have worked for James Cagney in one of those. He's got a Thompson submachine gun. He's wearing a newsboy cap. He is not from.
You're making fun of me here. See? You better not see.
So then Tatum and the police department comes in. Raven is trying to save the boss, which actually is good for the Card Queen because they're together, like very close together. So Card Queen takes a Bat Cousins. I'm going to be honest. I always get spades and clubs mixed up.
That's a club.
That's a club. If you look at a deck of cards, hearts and diamonds don't look anything alike. They are two different shapes. But clubs and spades, they both have the rounded bottom. So like one of them comes to a point, one of them comes to a circle. I don't like that. I wish they were two different. And it doesn't matter. But that's a...
One of them would work better as a shovel. So just think of that.
Spade, shovel, and that's an S. Okay, so club and three C's, I guess. Okay, so that's a club. So she takes club her club clover. And she's clubbing her... Oh, club clover. Okay, I'll try it. Okay, so she takes that and she wraps them up and they fall to the ground, which is great. And then... What does Robin do? Robin kicks. And I like that a lot. Kurt Schaffenberger, I love you. That's when all the guys are shooting at Robin and they shoot at the big, not jumbotron, but
$1 million to the man who kills Robin. The guy's really desperate.
Back when a million really meant something.
So then there's a great panel of Card Queen who is using her diamonds, because diamonds look different than hearts, diamonds to pin the two females. And then Raven's flying away.
He takes off.
He gets out. Robin and Card Queen wrap up the bad guys. And then Lieutenant Rick Tatum says, what about the Queenie here? Isn't she one of them? And Robin said, she only pretended to be Lieutenant. She's really one of us. The next panel, you get some great shading on Robin's face, which is great. It says, you got it. And as for you, Card Queen, I think I prefer you as Duella Harlequin Dent.
Which is totally the way you'd really speak, yeah, right? Yeah.
In parentheses. So then he's like, you left me the location of May's headquarters like a neon sign, real tough. I am kind of surprised that Duella wouldn't just tell him beforehand, because it's not like this happened in one day and she didn't have time. This was several like days in between, so she could have notified him somehow. And I guess she's probably figuring that he would figure it out. But I don't know. It just makes more sense if she would let him know beforehand. Yeah.
I don't think she always does things in ways that make sense.
Apparently, she must have had plastic surgery because her jawline is not anywhere what Harlequin's jawline was. Now, maybe she wears a prosthetic jaw as the Joker's daughter with that big long...
I would think she'd have to.
So then we get the 4-page Verzacus recap, which I will never tire of saying that. And Robin comes up. And the thing is, I don't think he actually really proves anything.
No, he's goading him.
He just accuses him. And then Dave's like, shut up, shut up. Shut up, shut up, shut up. If you're playing a drinking game while you're reading this and you drink every time Dave Corby says shut up, you're going to be hammered by page 9. And then I do think it is good that, Captain, you were talking earlier about secret identities. He is trying to a little bit to hide it because Dick gets punched in the arm and he's like, ow.
Yeah, you know that didn't really hurt him.
Yeah.
Even that, I think he could have avoided the punch.
Yeah. Dick gets in like 183 punches and Dave gets in like one.
Well, Dave's gone a little wild. You know, he spouts some extra arms there on page 9.
Yep.
One thing though, where Dick might live up to his name is he says, "What kind of a boyfriend are you? Not telling her about your glamorous other identity, Dave."
Yeah.
I kind of thought that was
hypocrisy.
Yeah. And I guess because we talk about it, are we assuming that Lori knows? Yeah. So I didn't like that part. I do, however, like that the last page of the story is word balloonless.
Yep. Silent.
So that's neat. I do like that part.
If Lori knows, then leaving her crying, you know, and not on good terms, that's dangerous.
Yeah, that's really true.
It took me a while to figure out who the guy she's holding. That's Uncle Frank, the head of police, of course. All the guys are like, "Wow, you really took him out." And he's like, "I'm out of here." You know, you can see how this evolved. I'm done with this. I'm moving on to new things. I got a alien princess coming my way in a year or so. So, Lori, your ancient history.
Is this when he dropped out of Hudson?
It's probably coming. I mean, Jack C. Harris takes over next. I haven't read ahead, but it's coming very soon.
I don't think.
You don't think it's so? It's before the New Teen Titans, though, isn't it? He's already out of college.
Does it happen in Detective?
I don't know.
It happens after that.
Well, you've got about just under a year and a half till the New Teen Titans start, and I think by then he's out.
By then he's definitely out.
Mm-hmm.
One question I have specifically for Paul Captain, if you remember or know, and Bat Cousins, if you know, originally in Teen Titans, didn't Bob Razzaca said Harlequin is going to show up somewhere else?
Yeah.
Was he thinking about this? Is this where she was appearing that you wouldn't?
I don't know. It felt like at the time she was going to get like a backup strip.
Right. But maybe this is what he was talking about.
Maybe there would have been more adventures because we only got the Card Queen for 2 issues. So maybe there would have been several issues with the Card Queen in her, maybe some solo strips with the Card Queen where we don't know who she is. There's all kinds of things it could have been. It felt like to me it was supposed to be her own 8-page story, you know, a few of them.
Yeah.
But who knows? Like I said, he had to wrap things up.
When I was reading this back in 1979, the issue before, I didn't know that that was Joker's daughter. It did come as a surprise to me.
That's excellent.
If you think about it, her real talent, Harlequin's real talent, is pretending to be other costume characters.
Yeah, it's disguise. Yeah. She's a disguise. Yeah. It's totally in character for her to do this because she's been Joker's daughter, Catgirl, the Riddler's daughter, the Scarecrow's daughter, Harlequin, Card Queen. That's 6 identities right there. That's pretty impressive.
Oh my gosh. She could be the supervillain target because she uses her disguises to dress up as other people.
She's almost dilates for hero without a dial.
Yeah. All right. So, hey, before we get to our last story, usually I do the Bat Family history after the story in which the creator is acknowledged, but I didn't want to bump into Gabriel's horn. We are about to read a story that's illustrated by Dick Dillon, and this is his only appearance in Batman Family. So I wanted to spend a little time on him. Dick Dillon was born in New York in 1928. He was an art student at Syracuse University on the GI Bill following his military service with the U.S. Army in Japan. Dillon had wanted to be a comic artist since he was a child, and he eventually did work for Fawcett and Fiction House, which led to drawing for Quality Comics beginning in 1952. He worked on titles such as Love Confessions and Love Secrets, but his big break was the popular title Black Hawk. He drew Black Hawk from 1953 to 1956 for Quality Comics, from issues 64 to 107, but then Quality Comics went out of business. Dillon, searching for new work, eventually tried DC Comics, who had just acquired the Quality Comics characters, including Black Hawk. While he was there, he saw a few issues of Black Hawk on the desk as he was being interviewed, and to his relief, he was told, "We've been trying to get in touch with you." He then turned around and continued to draw Black Hawk without missing a beat from 107 in 1956 until its cancellation in 1968, recording a grand total of over 175 issues of that title. Wow. At the same time, he dabbled a little bit in animation storyboards for the Transluxe syndicated TV series Johnny Zero from 1962 and The Mighty Hercules from 1963. So when Black Hawk's book initially ended, he went on to draw every single issue of Justice League of America from 64 to 183, which is 1968 to 1980, except for 4 planned reprint issues and a fill-in issue in 153, penciled by George Tuska. He drew Hawkman, World's Finest, and some other titles like Green Lantern, Superman, and Action Comics from time to time in his spare time. So think about that. From 1956 to 1980, in a span of 24 years, he drew 175 issues of Black Hawk, followed up with a mere 115 issues of Justice League with all those characters and some other stuff along the way. Winnie at time, amazing. Some highlights of Dylan's tenure in Justice League include the introduction of the Red Tornado in his first issue, number 64. Along with Denny O'Neill, they made a lot of changes to the membership of the Justice League by removing founding members Wonder Woman and Martian Manhunter and migration of Black Canary from Earth 2 to Earth 1. The introduction of our favorite, the Justice League Satellite. The return of the Seven Soldiers of Victory in issue 100 and the quality characters and the Freedom Fighters in 107. The return of Wonder Woman in the team in issues 128 to 129 and 76. A new origin story with Steve Englehart in 144. And of course, the murder of the original Mr. Terrific in 171. Notably, and one of my favorites outside of the Justice League, Dylan and writer Bob Haney created the Super Sons in World's Finest Comics number 215 in 1973. It just goes on and on. My main research here, a couple of articles in back issue, and I'll include links to all those places. But some quotes from that back issue number 64. First from his son, Richard. Quote, it took him some time before he got to the point where he considered he had all the characters mastered. And at the end, he probably still didn't consider he had them all mastered. It was quite a lot to get all the superheroes in one cover or one story and have them look right. I know that when he did Blackhawk, this was the post-World War II era, and right up until Vietnam, he was still getting mail from people saying that certain insignias were wrong on the uniform. So he had to watch out for that sort of thing. He was very passionate about his drawing and his comic books, really trying to be accurate. And from his wife about his work habits, quote, he would go up to the last minute, meet the deadline. He would say, I'm not going to get it done. He seemed stressed, but he always got it done. And his daughter, Terry, said that, quote, he got very excited by the scripts. He would never read the whole thing. Instead, he read it as he went along so he could visualize the story as it unfolded like a reader would. I thought that was really neat. You know, you would think people would read the whole thing, get a sense of it, and then go back. But no, that's really cool. And finally, comics pro Marty Pasco, who worked on several Justice League stories with Dylan, said, quote, Dick was affable and always a gentleman. He drew what the script called for, and he did it uncomplainingly and pleasantly and brilliantly. Pasco recalled that he would come into the city to deliver pages and person, even when his health started to fail, and you could see from his flushed face and heavy breathing that he was in pain. Sadly, Dick Dylan passed away in 1980 at the age of 52 from a heart attack. He had completed the first 2.5 pages of JLA 184 when he died. Of course, we know that George Perez and Frank McLaughlin took over the book and started that issue from scratch. I've included also a great blog article written by someone named Kevin Wilson about why he loves Dick Dylan. And for those fans who want to read a bit more about his artistic style, please see the link in the show notes. I have also included a link for the digital edition of back issue number 58, which spotlighted the Justice League in the Bronze Age, including an article about the Satellite era and the quotes above, with also a 2-page art gallery by Dick Dylan. Finally, I've also scanned a great 2-page interview with Dick Dylan conducted by Jack C. Harris in the pages of Amazing World of DC Comics number 11 from 1976, which also sports a fantastic Dick Dylan cover of the Bronze Age villains kicking the Justice League out of the magazine. Check out the article in the gallery. Overall, Dick Dylan had a tremendous career. I think all of us who grew up on the Satellite era of the Justice League think of his Justice League with tremendous fondness. According to Mike's Amazing World, Dick had an amazing 687 story credits, 8,526 pages. Just tremendous. This is his only appearance in Batman Family, so it was great to get a chance to talk about him.
Thanks a lot. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that was great. I really found that interesting.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you say that because I ran across some of the Satellite era Justice Leagues as I was getting this comic out of my short boxes, and I looked on those comics with tremendous fondness.
Yeah, it's hard to not love it. I agree.
I hadn't realized how young he was. 3 years younger than I am now.
Let's move on to our sixth and final story, starring the Batman in a terribly serious tale, Gotham's Great Kangaroo Race, an 8-page masterpiece written by Denny O'Neill and art by Dick Dylan and Frank McLaughlin, and has never been reprinted. I don't know why. It's not even in DC Universe in this issue, which is weird. So Brett will have to go back to the dark web to get this one. Although, you know, maybe, don't tell anybody, maybe I'll just put all 8 pages in the notes so you people can read the story. Not that you're missing a lot.
Offending Australians.
Yeah, maybe. Batman in Gotham's Great Kangaroo Race. Bruce Wayne is sponsoring a kangaroo chariot race with a prize of exactly $125,000. The citizens of Gotham aren't sure why, but hey, the idle rich, right? After Bruce completely disses a lady from the charity, the Children's Clinic, we cut to a scene in The Batcave 2, where once again, to Sean's delight, Bruce is working out with no shirt on. Of course, the kangaroo race is an attempt to smoke out Swagman Ginty, who is purchasing some illegal firearms, which happened to cost exactly $125,000. We then find out that the Swagman is Australian. And of course, all Australians have experience working with kangaroos. Swagman, in disguise, Natch, wins the race and Bruce hands over the cash. But of course, the cash has a tracer in the briefcase and Batman shows up to nab not just the Swagman, but also the arms dealers. And to no one's surprise, we end up with the children's clinic on Gotham's, quote, poverty-ridden South Side, getting an anonymous donation to keep them in business. The end. Captain, anything to say about the great kangaroo race?
I will say, I mean, we're all waiting to pounce on this thing, right? Like, no kangaroo pun intended. And this is my least favorite story of the issue, but Dick Dillon's art's great. And there are some entertaining things here. So I'm looking forward to talking about it with you.
Sean?
Denny O'Neill wrote the first story in this book, and Denny O'Neill wrote the last story.
That's the first note I have on my unbelievable.
I thought about that too. I think he was trying to prove I can do silver edging into Bronze Age silliness. They don't all have to be epic masterpieces.
I guess I'm funny on this show, and then, you know, if someone comes to me with a problem, I guess I'm serious and can help them out and be mature, but man.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, it's cute. It's silly. The little kangaroo in the title of the story, I think that's cute. I'm sure Martin will have something to say about that. The lunch pail guys and the society ladies are making fun of Bruce. I think that's funny. The diss of the charity lady, I was like, ouch.
And that doesn't even make sense at all because he is the philanthropist now because the Wayne Foundation. And
that made no sense.
That's kind of a carryover from the Idol Playboy.
I guess.
He's still got to maintain some of that, you know, and he's got to be flaky. And I think the whole kangaroo race thing, plus dissing the charity lady, he's got to come across as somebody who is not a serious human being. That helps him not be Batman in the eyes of the public.
One thing this story reminds me of is a couple years ago, downtown Baltimore decided that they're going to have automobile races in downtown Baltimore.
Like Monte Carlo or something?
Yes, yes. Basically shut down the town and made, quote unquote, quote, made those streets available for racing. It had to be a horrible failure because I think maybe it lasted 3 years. I don't even know if it lasted this long, but this is exactly what this, how are you going to do a kangaroo race? It makes no sense. I guess we're not going beat by beat in this story.
No.
I guess I quote unquote understand the logic where he's Australian. He knows about kangaroos. I'm going to give him this $125,000 as a prize so that he doesn't knock over a bank or take people hostage, but just give him the money then, and then you can arrest him.
Well, you can't just give him the money as Bruce Wayne, then, you know, he wouldn't trust that.
Yeah, it's fun. It's silly. I have to say, as a child of the 70s myself, the outfits of the guys in the kangaroo race, they reminded me of the Wacky Racers.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't know if you guys watched that cartoon.
Yeah, Dick Dastardly. Yeah.
And the dog went...
Oh, was that the Laugh Olympics?
No, there was the Wacky Races. They had crazy cars.
But they were on, those characters were on Laugh Olympics.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, they did later. Yes. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
So I know we're not going beat by beat, but I do have a couple things I want to point out. I looked up kangaroo racing to see if anybody had ever done this.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And the answer is no. And the whole idea of, you know, we know Swagman Ginty has worked with kangaroos. Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if anybody actually works with kangaroos or what that technically means. Maybe if you're a veterinarian at a zoo. Anyway, they're not domesticated animals, right? There is video of a kangaroo jumping onto the track at a horse race.
Oh my God.
I would encourage you to look that up. But that's as close as anybody got to kangaroo racing. I wanted to say that it was really cool to have a fourth world crossover on the splash page because that looks like Mr. Miracle in the chariot riding kangaroo. When you go to story page 3 and you see, for Sean's benefit, Bruce is working out, he's doing some kind of clean and curl, and that's got to be a couple hundred pounds of weight. peak human physical whatever. I'm not buying it. He's juicing. Those were my main bits. It does seem to me like Denny O'Neill was trying to show us that he can do the whole breadth of DC's kind of over.
I think it's good that they carry over the thread from the Huntress. The little kid that's being treated at the hospital was that kid that was given the monies, and he must have got caught like in a fire and he was burnt, so he has to go to the
teleported to Earth one.
Yeah. So the little kid there looks like that kid there, so it must be him.
One of those weird parallels.
All right. John, you ready to go dancing?
I am ready to go to Gabriel's Horn. And in this segment, we take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening disco hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s. We'll talk about the most 1970s moment in this issue and from any of the stories, any and all of the stories. Captain, let's start with you. What do you have?
Playing true to form, and for the, or what I talk about in the comments thread of this show, going to be a lot of firearms in here, guys.
We would expect nothing less.
Of course not. In the Curse of Crime Alley, police officers are carrying 38 caliber revolvers, or Batman says that they should be. That's a very 70s thing. They have since switched to semi-automatic handguns that can carry more rounds and switch to more powerful ammunition because it doesn't do to be outgunned by the bad guys. But I will say his point that the 38 round doesn't go on forever. You're unlikely to hit a bystander a mile down the way. That was a good point.
Okay, so that was accurate. I was going to ask you if that was accurate. That's cool.
Yep. Yeah, it is. The Barsky twins car already talked about, beautifully rendered by Don Newton. The second Barsky twin, the one who gets the orthopedics lecture from Batman. The gun he eventually grabs is an old Luger, like World War II German Luger type thing. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people use those in Europe, even after World War II, and you would actually see them in the US back then. I think it's more of a collector's gun now.
Paul, do you have anything?
We talked before about the urban blight type stuff is a very 70s thing. We talked with Max about that. It's a couple issues and the building being constructed in poor materials. And then the only other thing I had, story page 8, I'm looking at Maxi Zeus's clock, Sean. That just feels 70s to me. What do you guys think? Bottom of page 8, Maxi Zeus is looking at his clock in that triangular shaped case.
I actually think it looks a little bit more like Art Deco.
Okay.
But maybe there was an Art Deco resurgence in the
70s. Okay. So that one was a stretch.
It's definitely out of time, though. Maybe like 1959.
Or maybe it was a Roman thing that Maxi Zeus said.
Yeah, he should have had Roman numerals.
For me, the story was timeless. Which means I didn't find anything.
All right. Story 2.
Human target story. The splash page shows an old World War II pineapple style Mark II grenade being thrown at the human target. Now, for the average person on the street, when you think of grenade, this is what you think of. But that's because of World War II movies. The Department of Defense got the last one of these out of its inventory in 1969.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the last one. In Korea, they had different grenades than this.
Oh, wow.
So it's not even really a 70s thing. It's more of a 40s thing, which at least fits with the retro musical theme for the movie. That's really all I had for Human Target, except another speakeasy moment was Christopher Chance's car, that 1930-something Cord. That thing was gorgeous.
The only thing I had in this one were the cameras on page 1 looked kind of old-fashioned. You know, we've talked about cameras before, and obviously there are people smoking. We don't even bother mentioning those anymore.
So I did have the smoking. Another one I had was hang gliding. I think hang gliding was very much like a 70s thing, because that's one of the stunt accidents. The other one, they compare the director to Ken Russell. So you think you don't know that director, Ken Russell, but his two biggest movies, especially for this crowd, was Tommy. The Who's Tommy, the rock opera. He directed that. Also directed Altered States. Now, he also directed a bunch of other stuff, but those are probably the two biggest
that's pretty good
titles for this.
Dates it. For yeah, Harvard. Dates it. How about Batgirl?
So again, on the splash page, they get the 70s stuff right away. And all throughout, these bad guys, the SAE, they're basically the Symbionese Liberation Army, the people that kidnapped Patty Hearst and did a bunch of other horrible things. It's as obvious a layover as Taco King is for Taco Bell.
Yeah.
The weapons they're carrying are MAC-10 submachine guns with suppressors. They are small, light, cheaply made, and have a high cyclic rate of fire. And that means that they spray a lot of bullets very fast. All these things make them pretty inaccurate firearms, which actually works for
in works story. For Batgirl swinging back and forth. There you
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
They weren't used a ton in actual crime, but you did see them in a lot of 70s and 80s movies. Oh, and the uniforms. So I said I was going to talk about that. The uniforms are period appropriate barely. And what I mean is you were no longer allowed to wear that uniform in 1983, and it was already being phased out by 1979.
Hmm.
But the whole thing with the ascot, that's a very military police thing. Mm-hmm. So they actually got a lot right with those uniforms.
Ah, cool. Excellent. I didn't really have anything in this story other than the newspaper that Batgirl is signing was from the same day, evening edition of the newspaper.
Oh, that's a good eye.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I had on Batgirl.
The only one I had is a corsage. Even back in the 70s, were people giving dates corsages? Maybe it just seems outdated now, but even back then, I think that seems... If you were dating in 1979, let me know if that was outdated then.
You're going on a date with Batgirl. You've got to do something. This is a special occasion.
How about the Demon? Did you guys have anything in the Demon? I had nothing. Captain, did you have anything? Yeah, none of us had anything.
Not a thing.
It's timeless.
The reports that could have taken place in the 570s.
And then Robin, you talked about the big screen. Yeah, but how about you, Cap?
The second to last page, the penultimate page of the Robin tale, you see Robin throwing a two-fisted uppercut. I don't think any combatives instructor in any discipline has ever taught anyone to throw a two-fisted punch.
Other than Captain Kirk.
Right. So, well, that's where I'm going. Leaves you pretty much defenseless. And if you clasp the hands like Captain Kirk always does, which Dick wisely doesn't do here, but if you clasp the hands together, it's a great way to break your fingers. But it looks powerful. So you used to see it on TV, especially Star Trek, or in the movies in the 60s and 70s.
Excellent.
I didn't have anything in particular for the kangaroo race, other than the obvious fact that we all remember how popular kangaroo races were in the 70s.
The only thing I had was the transmitter was pretty big.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I definitely had the micro transmitter, which is half the size. Because don't they say you can use a dollar bill to measure because the one edge is 2 inches and the other edge is 6 inches? Is that right?
I never heard that.
Yeah, so that micro transmitter was like 3 inches long.
Yeah.
The other thing I have, which I think maybe works, is Bruce Wayne says, I feel the kangaroo has been unjustly neglected in our country. We race horses, dogs, even human beings. I think we are kind of getting to the point where racing animals is not cool. And I think so racing a kangaroo in the 70s, I think definitely sets it. Because I think even dog racing.
I don't know. You're the Florida guy, Captain. Do they still do dog racing in Florida?
You know, I don't know. There's a track out by St. Petersburg. I don't know if they're actually doing live races there. I think they might just be doing televised events and take.
We'll let Chris Franklin, the Kentucky guy, argue with you about horse racing there, Sean. I don't know. The other kinds of races,
I know it still goes on. First of all, I don't think it's at the level it used to be.
Kind of like boxing. It's an older fashioned thing and people don't do as much, but there's still places who do it.
Right. But there are still places that do cockfighting, but that's not.
Yeah, that's true.
I think eventually, as we go on, I think that will be less and less and less.
Fair point.
As long as the mint juleps don't go away, I think that's the important part.
On that happy note, I think we're about wrapped up for the issue. We want to thank our very special guest, Captain Entropy, for stopping by the reunion this month. Captain, would you please be so kind as to remind folks where they might be able to find you?
Bat Cousin Paul, my usual joke is that entropy means disorder and chaos, and social media doesn't need any more of those things. So you can't find me anywhere. But I will say you can almost always find me in the Fire and Water comments boards. Sometimes you can find me on Longbox Crusade. And most recently, by the time this comes out, I should have appeared on the latest episode of Once Upon a Geek discussing Ted Lasso with Coach Patrick and Coach Shag. I'm hoping that is as much fun to listen to as it was to make, just like this episode. And I'm thinking about launching a campaign to be the first non-comics pro guest on Funny They Don't Look Jewish, the Jewish comics podcast.
Very good. Thanks, Captain.
Thank you so much. Thanks. You were great.
Thank you for being on the show. Now we're going to play a podcast promo. And when we return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Space, the final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Gimme That Star Trek,
A new episode every month, only at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back. Now we will read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 482, A Gorilla, A Demon, and A Mite, with our special guest, Todd Sarenbetz. First up, podcasting supermate and toy expert Chris from the House of Frankenstein says, "Great episode, guys. I'll even forgive Todd for not liking the Batmite story. It wasn't until you guys started covering this series that I realized Al Milgrom had been fired from DC by this time. How sad. And I'm not sure if this is a cross-sell, but AHI made a Robin figure in their line of superhero parachutists. I never owned Robin, but I still have a Batman figure. Our pal Brian Heiler has one and provided pics over at Plaid Stallions. And then Chris posted an awesome photo of a Robin parachute toy. Check it out on the website." And then Chris concludes with, "Oh, and McFarlane Toys has released a Whirly Bat in their Superpowers line. It's based on the 80s version that was famously drawn by Walt Simonson in Batman 312, the Calendar Man story, and fits right in with the classic Kenner Batmobile and Kenner's new Bat vehicles." Thanks, Chris. That is fantastic.
Very cool.
We really appreciate you posting that.
Next up, Bat Cousin Rob McCarthy chimes in. "I really do love Starlin's Adam Warlock beyond any other comic, so I love Starlin, but not so much the way he draws Batman. How do those ears fit through doorways? Writing-wise, though, this story is and was what I want from Jim Starlin. Why is the demon in Gotham anyway? I guess that was Kirby saying, go ahead and use this character or other people. I think modern writers are missing a lot of plots by not having the demon controlled by summoners. I love Batmite. Thanks, Rob."
Bat-nephew Isamu Hideki Yukinori dropped some more wisdom on us. "That section of the original Batman Family number 21 cover featured in the Batmite story looks like a vignette of the demon. The tail of the word balloon goes right across his face. It looks like the demon story was supposed to be included in the previous issue, but was likely moved here to make room for the Denny O'Neil and Marshall Rogers story." Thank you very much. That is a fantastic find. That's great. And Bucky749 chimes in with his food preferences. "Hey, old chums, it's Cousin Bucky back this time. I brought Loud House cookies, orange sugar cookies with blue-white chocolate chips. Yum. Thanks, Bucky."
Next up, Dr. Ange drops by the reunion. "This is the one I've been waiting for. I vividly remember this comic having received it as part of a Christmas present package the year it came out, and so much of it has stuck in my brain. First and foremost, this was my introduction to the demon, and the Michael Golden art was just ambrosia for little Ange. That art is so sumptuous and so detailed and just different from the usual house styles that it has been indelibly seared into my mind. I couldn't wait to read more. Alas, no Golden art next time. And switching to Ditko, mind-altering. I can remember loving the Batmite story as a kid, even if I didn't know who all the people were. Being on Earth Prime did make it a hoot. And the Batman story was also a wild one. You put P. Craig Russell over Jim Starlin and magic happens. Obviously, Batman can't kill the villain, so I thought the security guard actually brought a touch of realism into an otherwise crazy story. I mean, you would think by now a well-intentioned security guard or police officer would have shot the Joker in some kind of spree. And heck, as an older guy, I also wouldn't mind becoming Bruce Wayne and living a life of luxury. Seriously, when this show started, I was pumped knowing this demon story was going to be reviewed. Too fantastic. That's all. Gone, gone, the form of Ange." Thanks, Ange.
That's great. Next up, Bat Cousin Matthew Davis. "Hello, cousins. Well, it looks like the kids are getting comfy in the old ancestral home. They're even inviting distant relatives and some of the neighbors over to hang out. Let's look at this issue. Earworms. Batman. Operation Mindcrime by Queensryche. I've never heard of it. Simon's plan has a big flaw. If Bruce Wayne quits being the Batman and adopts a hedonistic lifestyle, doesn't he think that people will notice? Not just Dick, Alfred, and Barbara, but also Clark, Diana, Barry, and a whole league of others? One session with Wonder Woman's lasso, and he's exposed. This is also around the time Zatanna joined the league, I think. Batgirl. Song choice, Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy. I've never heard of it. I like that opening sequence with everyone's reactions, especially Dick's, who may be more worried about the Chinese captors than the captives. Even though he was in Japan, Tony made pretty good time considering he had to sneak into China. Too bad we don't see a better reunion between him and his sister, or with his father. And do you think Barbara told her father about Tony? I can't imagine she wouldn't. But how do you tell someone the son they thought died
had survived, but now was dead. The Demon. Song choice, Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones. So is that the woo-woo, woo-woo song? Because if it is, then I kind of know it. If it's not, I don't know it. Wait a minute. This isn't a bat someone. It's not even an old family friend or one of Bruce's work colleagues. He did help out Man-Bat recently, and he's based in Gotham, so I guess that's something. Michael Golden's artwork is so well-suited for dark and mysterious characters like this, so of course, he won't be back next issue. Len Wein did a fantastic job summarizing the character's origin. Very helpful for a reader like me who had seen very little of him at the time.
Yep.
Batmite. Song choices, New York, New York by Sinatra. That's a classic. Or Arthur's Theme by Christopher Cross, which was written by Burt Bacharach, who I absolutely love. Getting back to his comment. Who knew they passed around hallucinogens at the DC offices in the 70s? This was a fun little diversion. And Bob Smith's, quote-unquote, they send Vinny after you, line is the best. It would be better, though, if DC Universe had included page 4 on its site. I didn't realize that. I have the issues, so I read them, so I didn't realize
I that. Didn't notice that either, yeah.
Robin, Eye in the Sky by Alan Parsons Project. I know this one. So, Maze is still up and running and out of New Carthage, no less. Setting up headquarters in a college town that's home base for a superhero that's beat them twice before reveals their mission statement, revenge first. A better one would be, let's quit being criminals and bring these high-res, full-color, big-screen monitors to market. Love that, yes. He goes on to say, Card Queen has an interesting motif, but a villain pretending to be a hero? Gee, how two-faced can somebody get? Wait, look at the hair color. Could this be someone from Robin's life? Could it be Lori? That's going to put a dent in any chance of her and Dick getting back together.
I see what he did there.
Between the Sino Superman and the Raven Maze storylines running at this time, it feels like Bob Razakis had some good ideas for continuing storylines, but being limited to around 11 or 12 pages per issue affected how well he could build up the story. This is Sean now. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's even worse when the stories are 8 pages, because then you don't even get side characters or anything like that. But even 11 and 12 pages, which was kind of big for that page count, even then it's tough to tell the story. I agree with you. So getting back to his comment, one 70s moment you missed was the reporter in the Batgirl story on page 2, panel 2, with the hat and the tag that says press. Too bad another reporter doesn't have a button that says pull. For a real Three Stooges moment.
Next up, Bat Cousin Brian Schufo. I wonder if Xavier Simon also thought about putting his brain in the body of a famous actress, just like the Ultra Humanite did. He could have chosen Rita Farr, which in my opinion would be a better choice than an ape. Imagine he mixed up Rita Farr with Jamie Farr. That's a prequel I'd love to read. Thanks, Brian. And then my bat buddy Dan chimes in. Great content on a great issue. Excellent background on the Kirby's Demon. You guys should do a deep dive on one guest star or villain like that in every episode. I was a reader of the Demon in its initial run, and I still learned a lot. I did know about the Hal Foster connection. Okay, Dan, if you want to write up the deep dive and I send them over to me, I'm happy to. I don't know if this is still the case, but back in the day, comic artists all had tons of books with pics of dinosaurs, airplanes, guns, ships, furniture to reference and swipe from. With Google, I guess maybe they don't need to do that today. Again, I would imagine that's right, Dan. I mean, you look at pictures of old-timey artist studios and they had tons of books where they would use for reference. And nowadays, they probably only need their computer. He goes on to say, listening to what you were saying about Kirby's desire to get out of the trenches, sounds like he preferred to draw at the stage and the creating, writing, etc. wasn't as much fun for him once his fourth world got canceled. I don't know, maybe he was looking fondly back on his mid-60s time at Marvel when he was just doing Fantastic Four, 10 pages of Captain America, and so on. He did so many covers. From what I've read, not only did he tend to hunker down in his den for 12 or more hours a day, but he was very fast and was able to produce twice as many pages as anyone else without sacrificing quality. I've read that too. Again, my opinion is based on just what I've read, Dan, and that's, you know, he really wanted out of the grind, and some of that artwork was a grind, but I think his biggest desire was to make more money for his family, and he saw editorial and creative come up with the idea for the Demon but then pass it off for somebody else to do. But I think he was stymied at both DC and Marvel. But there are many better Kirby scholars out there than I am, so I defer to any bat Kirby scholars to chime in on that. Anyway, once again, fantastic show. You guys are as omniscient as the eye of Agamotto. Thanks, Dan.
Bat fashionista Liz Ann Oswald says, impressive podcast, most impressive. The cover looks cool, though very 70s with the headshots. As for the first story, it was good to see Bruce got that monkey off his back.
Ba-dum-bum-psh.
Ah, Batgirl. Oi, that was of its time. Ah, on to Batmite. Kind of a cool bit. Next, the Robin story is fine. The copter seat thing is weird. Is that Dula dressed in that ridiculous outfit? Did she see all the goofy things Babs wore and thought, Dick likes women who look like they dress in the dark? And she decided to make an outfit so craptacular that Kitty Pryde wouldn't wear? And it's red and yellow. Is she now pretending to be the daughter of Hulk Hogan? Anyway, can't wait for the next podcast.
Next up, our bat cousin from across the pond, Martin Gray. And I'm back at the picnic, bringing the same treat as last time in the hope that they'll be correctly named as corn flake, not corn flour cakes. Sorry, Martin. Another top podcast. Good to hear Bat Cousin Todd back. I like the cover overall, but my quibble is that in the circle, Batgirl is further back than everyone else. Maybe to show off her bat signals? Is that probably right, Martin? I actually didn't notice that, but I think you're right. In the Batman tale, the story was better than the art, which looked rushed, unfinished, thanks to Sean for giving us his jail cell tango. Regarding the comics published that month, contrary to DC's cover blurb, I had not literally been demanding Supergirl and Batman and the Brave and the Bold, but I was incredibly pleased to see someone other than Wildcat, the Metal Man, Plastic Man, or Green Arrow. Certainly seeing Jim Aparo draw Supergirl was a massive treat. Having a script by someone other than Zany Haney only improved matters further. So what song was Sean singing, in quotes, or homaging regarding Batmite? This self-referential short was so much better than the rubbish Marvel came up with when they got self-indulgent, such as meeting David Letterman. I wonder if Bob Ruzakis was inspired by the Impossible Man visiting the Marvel offices in 1976. Interesting that Todd Klein got a credit for his production role. Maybe he supplied lots of artistic reference to Michael Coleman.
Now, in the script, Paul wrote, Sean replies to this attack on his singing. But honestly, when I saw that Martin put the word singing in air quotes, I think that is the perfect description of my warbling. And if I can audibly air quote my singing, I absolutely think that is spot on, Martin. That's fantastic. So then Matthew Davis jumped in and said, Sean redid the lyrics to the theme song from the TV show Alice, a very 70s American show. Like my wife, Sean must be hooked on antenna TV. So this is where I can't let it go, because you think I would just go on and say yes and then go on to the next one. Now, I absolutely love the idea of antenna TV and me TV. And definitely if I'm flicking through, sometimes I will watch. But I can never watch a whole episode. First of all, they're all cut up. Back then, these episodes were probably like 24 minutes, and now they're 20 minutes. Plus also, even though we have digital tuners and everything and HDTVs, most of these shows have not been remastered, and a lot of them just look washed out and crappy. Most of these I'll watch literally on DVD. The nice thing is you can get whole series box sets for like $30. So I just recently bought Maud. I'm going to get One Day at a Time because I love that show. So sometimes I will watch antenna TV and MTV. I love the idea. But Matthew's definitely right. It is Alice. And I loved watching Alice more so even than the show. I love that theme song. I'm a huge theme song fan. So that's why I incorporated it. Martin Gray comes back and says, thanks. If memory serves, it was based on Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, the movie, which is correct. I think I saw an episode when it played late night here, but it seemed to be about a lot of women washing dishes, which that could be an episode because they all work in a diner. And then Martin says, I am annoyed that I can't remember who took over from the film Alice onto the TV show. He looks it up. Ah, Linda Lavin. She's got possibilities, I suppose. Martin, I see you. I hear you. I love what you did. I don't think most of the audience does, but I love it. She's got possibilities. And we'll leave it at that. But I love you, Martin.
Martin goes on and says he is amazed that Sean never focused on page 7, panel 4 of the Robin story. Has there ever been such an extreme close-up of Robin's feathered crotch? It is a fun compliment to the close-up of Card Queen's hips on page 10, panel 4. Juan Ortiz was testing the comics code here, I reckon.
As the Fire and Water Network senior speedo correspondent, I am disappointed that I didn't make mention of this, and I shall endeavor to do better in the future, Martin.
Every issue of this comic makes me further stunned that Batgirl has been honored with not one, but two Bronze Age omnibuses. Her strips were thoroughly forgettable until Velvet Tiger debuted. It has to be the Bat Anything Sells business. So I have actually both those omnibi, Martin, and they are nice books. They're not quite as thick as some of the other omnibus out there, but she had a lot of backup tales on Detective both before this and after. They also include her other appearances with Batman and World's Finest and with Superman. So there's plenty of material. So yeah, it's got a bat on it. They'll put it out now and people will buy it. Suckers like me, I guess. And he goes back to say, Michael Golden did great work on The Demon. It's a shame the printing was so murky. I'm stunned by the sharpness of Randy's wrestling shorts. Don't he? And Jason usually wearing nappies when they bump uglies. An expression I've heard on the telly, I expect I'm using it correctly?
Only kind of, sort of. So as far as I like bumping uglies, I think that's actually doing it with no scraps of fabric in between. I don't really like that. I also don't like when they call it junk. It's not junk to me. It's a treasure. Don't call it junk. As far as nappies, I know what... So nappies are diapers. And I know that because way back in the day, Wham, back when they were Wham UK, had the song Young Guns. If you're happy with a nappy, then you're in for fun. And I had to find out what that meant. And that meant a diaper, if you're happy with a diaper, because the guy is marrying his girl and then he's going to have babies. So I know what that means. So yes, Martin, you basically are doing it correctly. Yes.
When Sean says, oh my, is he deliberately giving us George Takei impersonation? It's very impressive.
So not deliberately. It definitely could have seeped into my unconsciousness. Although if we're talking Sulu, I'm definitely a John Cho Sulu man, because I think that man is breathtakingly handsome. I love John Cho. I've sat through a lot of John Cho stuff that I don't care about because I care very much about John Cho. I'm definitely not denying it. I like George Takei. I think he's cool. So I'll say it's an homage, but I don't know that I did it on purpose.
Thanks as always, Martin. We love your comments. We look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months.
And we end up with Bat Cousin, past and future guest, Brett Young. Hey, Bat Cousins. Sorry I'm late. I was at the Howard Johnson's and came up with this fantastic comic book character concept. But then I had about 5 Brandy Alexanders and blacked out during the whole thing. Anyway, I brought some leftover pork chops and baked beans. A fun start to the issue. Simon had the most elaborate plan I've ever seen to get some Strange. They've got pills for that now, man. You don't have to involve a gorilla. Pretty cool seeing Batman fighting a big ape and getting absolutely wrecked. But I liked that Bats had to get a little lucky. And good for the security guard being the hero. That's a job position with a high turnover, as they're usually cannon fodder for Gotham villains. Put this guy on the recruiting poster. I don't have that much to say about the Batgirl story, other than, why does Dick have the TV facing the left arm of the couch? Who watches TV with their neck craned completely to the left? Hey, Dick, can you circumvent the end table and the lamp directly in front of the television and change the channel? Oh, man. Michael Golden makes the Demon story sing. Awesome giant apartment for Jason Blood, but at least it's earned. If I was an immortal demon, I would absolutely be F.U. money rich and have giant oil paintings of myself covering the living room walls. I bet he's even got coffee. Now, this next part I have to read because he wrote it, but I can't believe my mouth is going to form these words that Brett wrote. My eyes are tearing up. In honor of my Bat Cousins, I will read what he wrote.
It's your journalistic integrity.
Yes, we'll call it that. Brett says, sadly, Golden's talents are wasted on a seemingly endless Batmite story. I'm with Bat Cousin Todd. I'd rather take art lessons from Don Heck than read a Batmite story. Brett only redeems himself with the next sentence when he says, what they should have used these pages for is a collection of Gotham real estate listings, a cathedral ceiling, 3 bedrooms, 2.5 bath brownstone in the Diamond District for $500 a month? Awesome. Brett goes on to say, finally, I'm coming around on Juan Ortiz. The clean, simple, cartoony art works as a classic comic style. He'd be right at home drawing a JSA story. This is Sean. I loved saying those words. Back to Brett. Robin tops his TV layout idea by flying a vehicle with spinning blades to save some guys in a hot air balloon. I actually like the look of Card Queen, But without reading ahead, I have a feeling I'll be disappointed by who she turns out to be. Well, gotta run. Great Aunt Ethel was abducted by Chinese radicals. So we're all going to gather around this small television and shrug. She'll be fine. Thanks, Brett, and everybody for your comments. We are now going to open up the social media portion of the show. And we're going to start off with Facebook, where Terry O'Malley posted, Terry, my new favorite Bat cousin, wrote, I love Batmite's New York adventure so much. And if I could have loved that post 4,583 times, I would have. We also got likes and mentions and stuff that got on Facebook from Max Romero, Terry O'Malley, Chris Franklin, Brett Young, Dan Greenfield, Mike Thomas, Doug Game Master, Darren Sutherland, Magazines and Monsters, Ruth Sutherland, Harry Schlitz, John Dredge, Michael Acheson, Herschel Mimas, Codex Omniversa, Bruno Diaz, Alistair James Dunbar, and Roger Preeb. And then going over, I'm going to open up my Twitter app, and I'm going to thank everyone who, I don't know, what do you do on quote-unquote Twitter?
You re-exit.
Whatever you do there, thanks for doing it. And the people that did it are the voice of Paul, but that's not Paul, that Paul, Bat Cousin Paul. It's a different Bat Cousin Paul named the voice of Paul. Paul has a voice, but this is the voice of Paul, not Paul, my co-host Paul, but the voice of Paul. And also, Between the Pages blog, Tall Tower, Irredeemable Shag, Michael Thomas, Rodney Tram, Brian Schufo, JMT-Prod, Kalish Walla Mucky. I'm sorry if I really messed up that name. Please phonetically let me know how to say that, and I will try to say it correctly in the future. Tim Price, the Pod Crasher, Ange, Alan Harvey, Restoration, not Recreation, Dave's Comics Heroes blog, The Bat Pod, Dr. Pop Culture, Chris, P. Brennan, and Jim Ball. Thanks a lot, guys, for all of your work with the social media accounts. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. But before we sign off, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of our other shows, please consider becoming a patron. We're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost. And we promise not to use any of the funds to sponsor a kangaroo race. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts. And thanks.
That will do it for this feedback section and for episode 483. We want to thank our special guest, Captain Entropy, for appearing on this episode. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next month as Batman goes after Maxie Zeus and Jaxie Harris takes on writing duties for Batgirl and Robin.